take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting September 22nd. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for September 22nd, 1692, The New World. Someday, in hopes of putting to rest the idea that the United States was founded on religious freedom, the last 8 women hung for witchcraft in America colonies happened. However, not only witches, but also Quakers and non-Puritan Christians were persecuted in the colonies. Also on September 22nd, 1861, in an unprovoked peacetime attack, Army soldiers massacre a band of visiting Navajo men, women, and children during a horse race at Fort Wayne, New Mexico. Mighty Christian of them. Also on September 22nd, 1862, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and the Union starts to recruit blacks to fight in the North. Robert E. Lee proposes using blacks in the Confederacy Army and emancipating them if necessary. However, another general angrily retorts, "If slaves will make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong." Duh. More First Nation Native American news in 1887, the Blackfoot Treaty. Surrendering 50,000 square miles, slightly less than the size of the state of Washington, in southwest Alberta. According to Blackfoot Chief Yellowhorn, chiefs never touched the pen and signed the treaties. The treaties were fraudulent. The chiefs were not told what was going on and did not have anyone to explain it to them. They have stolen our nationality from us. We are not Canadian nor Americans. We are Blackfoot. More governmental terrorism happens on this date in 1985, when the French finally admit planting a bomb that sunk the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior ship in New Zealand. Also on September 22nd in 2001, New York City announces a $9 million settlement for Abner Louima for the police torture that happened 4 years earlier when police beat and sodomized Abner with a plunger. This Week in Radical History for September 23rd, Victoria Woodhull would be born on this date in 1838. She was an American suffragette who helped publicize the Golden Age newspaper. As a leader of the American women suffragette movement in the 19th century, she became a colorful and notorious symbol for women's rights, free love, and labor reform, as well as the first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872. Also for September 23, 1950, Congress overrides President Truman's veto and passes the McCarran Internal Security Act, requiring registration of members of groups the Attorney General determines to be communist fronts and establishing emergency concentration camps. Truman would call the act the greatest danger to freedom of speech, press, and assembly since the Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798. Today, KBR and Halliburton subsidiaries receive U.S. grants to build concentration camps throughout the United States, the biggest one in Alaska, where I'm sure the Palin family would volunteer to round up any commies sent their way. Two more items for September 23rd, 1983. National Kidney Foundation president decries as immoral and unethical a plan by Virginia doctor H. Barry Jacobs to buy kidneys from poor people, among them residents of the third world nations, and sell them to wealthier people who need kidney transplants. Of course, to this day, selling of body parts to wealthier folks is standard operating procedure in a lot of third world nations. On eBay. Lastly, for September 23rd, 1997, anti-authoritarian anarcho punk album Tub Thumper by the anarchist singing group Trumbawamba is released. Here's a little sample, a taste, a tease, if you will, a little more Trumbawamba.
A man walks into a think tank full of hooch and future sales, mixing wish lists with extension plans, read Guantanamo jail. Smell a solid beach, and a whiff of cannot fail, and a guilt trait shot with goblets, dripping cutthroat cocktails, and they drink a toast to Florida, and all its air-conditioned hum, and they damn the health of Cuba, and they damn its bona fide rum. He sips a Kalamata olive, spits out the stone, and he mimics crushing people. Talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, dealing with my hand. Nobody move, or the CEO kiss it in the face with cream and dough.
See them scramble to the top. Watch them fall from the
Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and booms and their itchy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum. Lying in his car, down in the basement, messing with the moment. Alchemy and elements, smashing up your instrument. Old Thomas Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and booms and their itchy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum. In the canteen down at Columbine, with
rags they never found,
striking matches up at
Waco
when they burnt it to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8
around
the grassy knoll.
Everything you know is wrong. There's a verse missing out of this song. Everything you know is wrong.
This week in Radical History for September 24th, 1794, President Washington orders militia to put down Whiskey Rebellion. Farmers in the western frontier revolt when the U.S. government attempts to tax the farmers excess grain use that they use to make whiskey. Tom the Tinker and others help organize a rebellion which mostly targeted tax collectors and their offices. The rebellion would eventually be put down by Washington himself. Also on September 24th, 1901, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman released from jail. Authorities had tried to make the case linking her to assassination of beloved President McKinley, but they would drop charges due to lack of evidence. In Wisconsin news in this date, in 1968, anti-war protesters destroy 10,000 draft files in Milwaukee. Lastly, for September 24th, 1969, Chicago 8 conspiracy trial begins, as U.S. government tries to put to trial 8 demonstrators and blame them for the massive disruption of the Democratic National Convention. At the end, the U.S. government was shown once again how much of an ass they can be. Now, after the RNC in St. Paul 2 weeks ago, a version of the Chicago 8 trials are being organized as 8 members of the RNC Welcoming Committee is being prosecuted on terrorism charges.
No one of us is the Welcoming Committee. The Welcoming Committee has become a target from Bob Fletcher, Ramsey County Sheriff, and from a lot of other law enforcement agents. This is an abuse of power, and when the abuse of power becomes this extreme, silence is not acceptable. When 8 people that I know and have been working with for the last year are being charged with conspiracy and acts of terrorism, silence is not acceptable. There are no terrorists on this stage. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't 8 of us. We are all the Welcoming Committee, and we stand together today.
And when will they come for you? This week in Radical History for September 25th, I only have 3 items. Yep, America is founded on freedoms, like on this date in 1690 when the first newspaper was published in colonial America. It was never published again. Censorship quickly raised its ugly head as the colonists decided the paper was too offensive and ordered the publisher, Benjamin Harris, to cease publication. Also on September 25, 1919, the Russian Revolution. After brutal oppression at the hands of the Bolsheviks, Cheka raids on anarchist groups, and the banning of an anarchist congress by Trotsky in June happened, underground anarchists retaliate by bombing the communist headquarters in Moscow. Underground anarchists bomb the headquarters of the Moscow Committee of the Communist Party in protest of the growing repression. 12 communists were killed and 45 others were wounded. Ain't it funny how at the same time in the United States the Palmer raids begin as governments start to seek out anarchists and jail them and or deport them. How can both communists and capitalists have the same enemy at the exact same time? Why? Because anarchist philosophy is a potent threat to authoritarian ideas, and they are, quite frankly, afraid of us. Lastly, on this date in 1975, Senate makes public 238 illegal FBI burglaries against dissident groups. The state crimes against the people were sponsored by Dwight had become revealed as COINTELPRO, an acronym for counterintelligence programs.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and the anti-war movement. And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows. And, you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong is going to happen, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King. By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
Don't let this happen to you. That was an audio segment from the Academy Award-nominated documentary, Weather Underground. I'll check it out sometime. This week in Radical History for September 26, 1970, in England, bombs explode outside a bank in Heathrow. Just days ago, Wimbledon and Hampstead Conservative Association were hit as well. Today there are simultaneous bombs attacks in Iberia, Geneva, Frankfurt, Paris, and London airports. One of the many attacks in England and France during this year, many attributed by the media to the anarchist Angry Brigade. Living up to the press release motto, Better Living Through Chemistry, in 1973, radioactive tritium discovered in drinking water near Rock Flats Dow Chemical Nuclear Power Plant in Colorado. Also on September 26, 1985, Senator Jesse Helms adds an amendment to an appropriations bill forbidding the use of any funds for the benefit of any cult organization or other group that has the purpose or that has any interest in the promoting of Satanism or witchcraft. It is adopted without debate, showing once again how America is all about religious tolerance. So mote it be. But we are not the only country with religious intolerance, like in 2002 in Burma, when 14 are sentenced to death for trying to overthrow the government by the use of magic. Last night on this date in 1997, Mexico, Zapatista rebels found an autonomous community in southern Chiapas that still operates to this day. This week in Radical History for September 28, 1893, Emma Goldman goes on trial in New York City, sent back to the tombs until the 18th of October, the day sent for sentence, with the judge giving a new rent-free home for a year in Blackwater Island Penitentiary. Her crime, given a speech. Also on September 28, 1901, in the Philippines, guerrillas ambush U.S. troops, killing 48 U.S. soldiers. General Jack Smith orders his troops to kill everyone on the island. Following his butchery, Hell-Roaring Jake was promoted to Brigadier General and put in charge of the Samar campaign to pacify our little brown brothers. In Samar, Smith earned fame with his orders to kill everyone over the age of 10 and make the island in a howling wilderness. In May of 1902, Smith was court-martialed and was forced retired with no other punishment. The travesty of our involvement in the Philippines, when we had designs to turn it into our westernmost state, and many of these turn-of-the-century atrocities go largely forgotten in this country's history. Also on September 28, 1917, 166 Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union activists, indicted for interfering with the war effort, you know, the war to end all wars, the first move on an illegal but successful U.S. government campaign to cripple the radical union movement. A year later in Canada, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union, is outlawed. Also on this date in 1919, a mob forms outside Omaha, Nebraska courthouse. The courthouse is set afire and Mayor Ed P. Smith is hung. They seize William Brown, a black man, accused of raping a white woman. He was tossed in jail, though he is crippled. The mob gets him, hangs him, shoots him, and then drags his body through the town. After committing these acts of murder, the mob goes on a rampage throughout downtown Omaha, breaking windows and stealing goods from storefronts. Troops are finally called in on the 30th to put an end to the chaos. It is considered one of the most notorious lynchings in U.S. history, involving tens of thousands of good Christian people. Two more items for September 28, 1973. ITT headquarters in New York is bombed by the Weather Underground in response to U.S.-backed coup in Chile. Lastly, in 1990, President Reagan says, quote, "We have never interfered with the internal government of any country," unquote. This guy was not only elected president, America loves to regale his fairy tales. Yeah, we've never interfered with the internal affairs of any country. Never. Never happened. Pay no attention to the man.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Those of us who follow the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are well aware of the heavy-handed pro-Israeli role that the United States plays in protecting Israel's interests. Yet they also hold themselves out as being honest brokers in trying to find solutions in what they characterize as a peace process. For our feature presentation this morning, you are about to hear former U.S. Ambassador to Israel and negotiator Martin Indyk trying to defend the role the U.S. is playing with a straight face. He is countered by a bright moderator and some Palestinian voices that challenge his absurd, indefensible positions. You are about to hear Indyk on Al Jazeera's program Head-to-Head with moderator Mehdi Hassan, and also featuring a panel with Palestinian author and activist Gardi Karma and others who will be introduced. Here is that broadcast of Al Jazeera's Head-to-Head with moderator Mehdi Hassan.
The U.S. funds the Israeli military to the tune of $3 billion a year. At the UN, Israel has no stronger advocate than the United States.
Those against.
And when it comes to the never-ending peace process with the Palestinians, critics say Israel couldn't have a more favorable mediator.
America will stand by the side of Israel every step of the way.
And all the while, Israel's expansionist settlement project shatters Palestinian dreams of statehood. My guest tonight has been at the heart of U.S.-Israel relations for decades and has been a trusted advisor to presidents and secretaries of state alike.
It's been my conviction for 40 years that peace is possible.
But after the latest failure, has this former negotiator now changed his tune?
I'm Mehdi Hassan, and I've come here to the Oxford Union to go head-to-head with Martin Indyk, former US ambassador to Israel who served as President Obama's special envoy on the Middle East. I'll challenge him on whether his country has acted as Israel's lawyer at the expense of the peace process, and why it is that the United States always seems to have Israel's back, no matter what.
Tonight, I'll also be joined by Dr. Garda Karmi, a Palestinian author and activist and research fellow at the University of Exeter's Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies. Rachel Sharby, an award-winning journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. And Professor Alan Johnson, senior research fellow at BICOM, the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Martin Indyk.
Currently executive vice president at the influential Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., he also led the most recent U.S. attempt to restart peace talks in 2013.
Martin Indyk, your former boss, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, has said that the United States can, quote, serve as the facilitator, the honest broker in an effort to reach a peace deal in the Middle East. But given the US supports, funds, arms Israel, the occupying power, that's nonsense, isn't it? The United States has never been an innocent abroad, to quote the title of your book. It's never been an honest broker.
Well, Mehdi, first of all, thank you for having me. I would say that the United States is pro-Israel, and that's what gives it its influence in the peace process. And that's the heart of the matter. We are not neutral. We don't claim to be neutral. We have an alliance with Israel. But in order to achieve another interest that we have, which is peace in the region, stability in the region, and a settlement that provides for the legitimate national rights of the Palestinians, we need to be able to influence Israel. Israel, as you say, is the occupying power.
And how has that worked out for you over 30 years?
Well, it's worked out very well in the case of Egypt. It worked out well in the case of Jordan. And we're still working at it in the case of the Palestinians.
Most people, when they look at this subject, would say, you know, if you were going through problems with your wife, God forbid, and you had to get marriage counselling, would you ask your wife's best friend to do the counselling?
Sure.
Because you would. My wife's You're probably the only man
friend who would,
probably
would understand
do.
My wife, would know how to influence my wife. Absolutely.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
You think that marriage counseling should be done by a party that's biased towards one side?
Well, we're not dealing with marriage counseling here.
True. It's an analogy. It's a point that most people understand, that if you want to broker an agreement between two sides, you have to have some credibility with both sides. You can't be seen as Israel's lawyer.
That is not a role that we should play. And when I was in the negotiations now heading them up for Secretary Kerry, it was a promise that I made to the Palestinians that we would not coordinate with the Israelis and agree on with the Israelis in advance and try to impose it on them.
But in earlier negotiations, you accept the Americans did that.
There were times when we did it.
Camp David, for example, in 2000. The line about Israel's lawyer is from your former State Department colleague, Aaron David Miller, who advised six secretaries of state on Middle East negotiations. He said at Camp David, U.S. officials acted as Israel's attorney, catering and coordinating with the Israelis at the expense of successful peace negotiations. He says both he and you brought a clear pro-Israel orientation to the U.S. peace process planning.
Yes, I am pro-Israel and proud of it. But I'm also pro-peace and determined that the best way to serve the Israel that I believe in, which is an Israel that is at peace with its neighbors, and particularly with the Palestinians, is to do whatever I can to help both sides achieve peace.
You say both sides. Nabil Shath says that you and Dennis Ross, quote, defended Israel more than the Israeli delegates did. That's what Shath says.
Well, that's Nabil Shath. What can I do? Have you heard that from Saar Barakat?
Let me ask you about
that. You don't have Saar Barakat's quote on that, do you?
I don't think Saar Barakat thinks that the U.S. government has been even-handed, but that's a question for another day. Here's what so many people find so fascinating and frustrating across the world. The United States not only insists on leading this process, but when things go wrong, when Israel, say, violates international law, the U.S. then promptly steps in to protect Israel from criticism, from censure. Over the past 44 years, I believe the United States has vetoed 42 resolutions at the U.N. Security Council critical of Israel. In 2011, the U.S. vetoed a Security Council resolution which basically had copied and pasted U.S. policy on settlement expansion into a U.N. resolution. You vetoed your own policy in order to protect the Israelis.
First of all, there are other things in that resolution that were unacceptable to the United States and against U.S. policy, and so that was a problem. But secondly, the United Nations in general and the Security Council in particular are very hostile places to Israel. And so we want to try to keep it out of the UN Security Council, out of the UN General Assembly, and try to focus it on a direct negotiation between the parties. Now, there are times when it might be appropriate for UN Security Council resolution. For instance, there's a settlement resolution coming up now. If it doesn't have objectionable things in it, I personally think it wouldn't be a bad thing for the United States at least to abstain on that, so that the settlers in Israel understand that it's not cost-free.
Abstain? That's as far as you'll go. The whole world is outraged by Israeli settlement expansion, illegal settlements, and the best the U.S. can do is an abstention.
That would be huge, Maddie. It means that the resolution would go through.
Do you know how much money the United States gives to Israel every year?
Yes.
How much?
Quite around somewhere between $3 and $3.5 billion.
$3 and $3.5 billion. Have you ever thought about withholding any of that money in order to try and get the Israelis to do the right thing?
Again, there are two points here. First of all, it's all military assistance, not economic assistance. Israeli economy is strong.
Which makes you complicit in the occupation, incidentally.
Fine. We're complicit in the occupation. We're doing our best to try to end the occupation. Okay? That's
by abstaining.
That's what we're about. Come on. So, the first point is it's military assistance. So to cut that aid, because we disagree with Israel's policies, is to send a message to Israelis that we're no longer going to be supporting their security. And why is that a problem? It's not just because they face some real threats in the region, but because if they feel that they cannot rely on the United States when it comes to their security, how are we going to get them to take risks for peace?
But the U.S. government has withheld money from the Palestinians, but you say it should never withhold any money from the Israelis.
I'm saying that there are consequences for withholding money in the present situation which would be negative towards the efforts that we're trying to make to achieve peace.
I'm not sure how it could be any more negative. Let's go to the panel who are waiting patiently. Rachel Sharby is an award-winning British journalist of Iraqi Jewish heritage, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Rachel is someone who's reported from Jerusalem over several years, followed these issues closely. Do you think the fact that the U.S. is so openly pro-Israel, that does or doesn't undermine peace talks?
You know, the U.S. Openly says that Israel is its strategic ally. It likes having a very highly militarized and pro-US ally, Israel, in the region. That's a US foreign policy interest. You talk about wanting a peaceful solution. You talk about mediation. Implicitly, there is an assumption of neutrality there that you constantly breach. And even if we're to accept it on the terms that you set, which is being pro-Israel gives you a lever, great, use it. You have consistently failed to use it. You've consistently allowed Israel to be unaccountable, to not uphold international law, to constantly violate Palestinian rights. What's the point of having a lever if you don't use it?
We have used the leverage. We've used it repeatedly. And that has produced, on repeated occasions, offers from Israel to the Palestinians, which have gone a very long way to meet their needs. And nobody else, not the UN, not the EU, not the United Kingdom, has been able to do that. Only the United States has been able to do that.
Alan Johnson was a professor of democratic theory before joining BICOM, the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Center, as a senior research fellow. Alan, other governments come together, as they did in 2011, for example, to try and pass this UN security resolution, basically calling for settlement expansion to stop, which I assume you support. Why can't the United States get behind those efforts?
Earlier this year, there were reports of adults dressed as clowns roaming the streets
the peace
of South
has
Carolina.
Made, has made
well,
no
the story
progress.
Has now developed
fact,
and taken a twist or a turn
made.
For the worst.
Palestinians
it turns out that these
Israel.
Alleged clowns
Israel
are now trying to lure kids into the woods. The creepy behavior allegedly began on August 19th when a resident relayed that her son said he saw clowns whispering and making strange noises in the nearby woods. The resident said she went down to investigate and saw several clowns in the woods flashing green laser lights. The figures then ran away into the woods. Several children said the clowns have appeared in the woods behind one apartment building and that they try to persuade them into the woods further by displaying large amounts of money.
When he says, look, the Palestinians need the Americans to be close to the Israelis because you're not going to be able to get a deal out of the Israelis without American involvement.
Well, all I can say is I've been listening to Martin Indyk very patiently, and honestly, I hope you won't be offended if I tell you, I have never heard so much baloney in my life.
But got to deal with the specific point that Martin raised.
I mean, quite apart from the partiality that the U.S. has towards Israel, which you've confessed, the very way in which this conflict is viewed is wrong. It's fundamentally wrong. We do not have equal parties, so you all talk about we leave it to the two parties. It's total nonsense, because what we do have is a dominant, powerful, backed by the biggest and most important state in the world on one side, and on the other, an occupied people with no friends and no resources. That's the truth. So why don't you start dealing with reality and show a bit of honesty? I'm sure you're a nice man, but it's not coming across.
Let Martin deal with that specific point.
If the Palestinians do not want the United States as the broker of the negotiations, they are free to go and seek any other mediator. Why do they accept the United States as a mediator?
Actually, they asked for the UN. They've asked for the UN to be a mediator, and you said it's our interest to take it away from the UN.
No.
You just said it to me 5 minutes ago.
When they want to negotiate with Israel, they want the United States in the room. They don't want the United Nations in the room. When they want to impose a settlement on Israel, that's when they go to the United Nations. But the problem with imposing a settlement on Israel is the only one that can impose a settlement on Israel is the one that won't do it, which is the United States.
Okay, conundrum. Isn't the problem the United States is this great power, and the world sees the United States, you know, you push around the United States, you get punished with all sorts of sanctions, invasion sometimes. Israel never seems to suffer any consequences for whatever it does. John Kerry turns up in Israel in 2014, the defense minister Moshe Yalon criticizes his mission as being motivated by a sense of messianism. Joe Biden goes to Israel in 2010. They humiliate the vice president by announcing 1,600 new settlement units while he's in town. America does nothing. Why does it continue to tolerate basically being slapped in the face by a close ally?
Yeah, I personally had a problem with all of that. And I think that we do need to make it clear to Israeli ministers on the right who think that they can clip a coupon at America's expense that it's not acceptable.
How do you make it clear?
Well, you know, they don't have to be welcomed in Washington, for example.
They don't have to be welcomed in Washington. The Prime Minister of Israel turns up in Congress last year to give a speech denouncing the President of the United States' signature foreign policy achievement. Yeah. Zero consequences. What does he get in return? $40 billion over the next 10 years. That's a good deal.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there are people in Israel who say he got away with it. I think that the Prime Minister made a big mistake. I'm on the record many times as saying
should he have to apologize for it?
I don't think that matters. I think he shouldn't have made the speech. He shouldn't have gone behind the president's back.
And yet in 2010, you wrote an email, which had now been released as part of Clinton's emails, in which you told her negotiating team that Netanyahu lacks a generosity of spirit and humiliates his Palestinian counterparts. You then, however, advised them, nevertheless, put your arm around Bibi, because there's no substitute for working with him, and the purpose of embracing him is to nudge him forward. It's basically no consequences for bad behavior. You reward bad behavior. He's really bad. He's self-defeating, I think you called his tactics. But nevertheless, give him a hug. Put your arm around him.
Yes, but it's
no consequences.
It's this, you see. That's the theory.
What does that mean? Put your arm around Bibi. So you were really calling for a headlock, not a hug. Is that what you're saying?
Close to it, yes.
Okay.
Thank
I'm just
you.
Wondering, have you ever asked for
Thank
the,
you for that interpretation.
Have you ever asked for the American government to put their arm around the Palestinian president? Just have only Israelis
yes,
get hugs?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because you don't account for the other side of this at all.
Okay.
And neither do you.
Well, let me...
Which is that the United States has moved dramatically on the Palestinian issue from treating it only as a refugee issue and insisting that it be dealt with through Jordan, to recognizing Palestinian national rights, recognizing our willingness to recognize a Palestinian...
That's
not true. We have worked harder than anybody else And I apologize to nobody for the efforts that we've made to try to resolve this problem.
Just very quickly, I notice in your book, you refer to Arafat as, quote, an artful dodger and as a bazaar merchant. I couldn't find you using such disparaging, some might say racial stereotypes, about Israeli leaders in your book in the same way. I'm just, it's your book.
Of course.
You said he was a bazaar merchant out to extort a customer in a hurry.
No.
Your words.
Not out to extort a customer in a hurry. But in any case...
For the bazaar merchant, customers in a hurry are the most vulnerable to extortion.
You know, Arafat is exactly what I described there.
And another phrase you've used over the years is demographic threat in reference to the growing Palestinian population inside the Green Line. Many Palestinians would say it's dehumanizing, it's inflammatory, racist even, to refer to Palestinian babies as a demographic threat.
I've never heard that before. I think that it's a complete misunderstanding of what the reference is to. The demographic threat is the idea that if Israel doesn't find a way to make peace with the Palestinians, it's the Jewish nature of the state and the democratic nature of the state will be in jeopardy. They'll be in conflict because by 2020, 2025, by some counting already, Israel will no longer have a majority of Jews in the Jewish state.
You're saying the
and
choice...
that's the demographic threat.
You've said the choice between being Jewish and being democratic, Israel will have to make that choice. We are at that point, you have said. You've said that Israeli settlements could, quote, drive Israel into an irreversible binational reality, even though you believe there's no other solution apart from the two-state solution. I always hear U.S. officials saying this. The window is closing. The time's running out. There's point of no return is being reached. At what stage does it become too late, in your view?
I honestly don't know it. What I know is when we get to that point, the two-state solution will be resurrected. It's like the kings and queens of England, you know. The peace process is dead. Long live the peace process. It keeps on coming back. Amazing thing, Mehdi. Okay. Amazing thing.
Ghada Kami, do you agree with Martin Indyk that it can't be too late because the two-state solution will simply be resurrected when the time is right?
There is no possibility of two states. For a very simple reason, that the land, the territory that would be needed for a Palestinian state hardly exists. It's full of Israeli settlements. But secondly, without the United States being able to use any kind of pressure on Israel, there will be no two-state solution. There'll be nothing. And the truth is that the U.S. is unable to pressure Israel. It's not unwilling, it's unable. Today, Israel is a one state. It rules another people. It occupies them in one state. But the problem with that one state is it's an apartheid state. One side has rights, the other has none. So the issue really is not having two states. The issue is converting this apartheid situation into one of equity and equal democratic rights and no apartheid. That's the thing before us.
Okay, let me bring in Alan Johnson, who's shaking his head there.
I just disagree with Ghada, not on the basis that the settlements aren't a problem. No disagreement there. The facts, though, if you talk to Settlement Watch, Peace Now, people involved in Israel in this process, they say to you a 6% land swap will bring about 35 of every 40 settlers back into little Israel, proper Israel. That's doable, that kind of land swap. The EU supports it, the United States supports it, and crucially, the Arab League now supports it. You asked a question before, when does it become impossible? I'll give you my answer. When it becomes politically impossible for Israel to bring back over the number of settlers that are needed in order to make the two-state solution
When's
possible. The reason I don't think we're near there yet, many settlers are economic settlers. They will come back with a compensation and relocation package. The Israeli public itself, when asked before a recent election, if we have to face austerity, what should be top of the list of budget cuts? They said the settlement project.
So why hasn't it happened?
Mehdi, I think your assumption is that Israel holds peace in the palm of its hand. It just won't open it.
But it holds the decision to build settlements in the palm of its hand, and it keeps doing it.
You do focus on settlements, which is fair, and I agree their problem, but you don't focus on the other side.
An Israeli news...
which is Palestinian violence, Palestinian terror,
obviously.
Palestinian rockets from Gaza.
So when I get...
When I get a diplomat from a country
that blindly backs the Palestinians, I promise you I'll ask him that question. Interestingly, you keep saying settlements are a problem. A unnamed US official from the peace talks told the Israeli press that the primary sabotage was the settlements. That was widely believed to be you. Was it you?
Well, that was an unnamed official, so...
Okay, but you're not denying it.
I'm sure that unnamed official knew what he was talking about.
Good. So me, you, and the unnamed official all agree that the primary sabotage was done by the settlements. Rachel Sharby, do you want to come in here?
We are talking about people's lives. Every day that you fail, people will die and suffer. So, you know, it's not a diplomatic spin game that we're trying to win here.
Believe me, I know that.
Okay.
I live with that every day.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
Believe me.
On the settlements, we have been watching this peace process for a long time. Oslo, Camp David, Annapolis, Washington, and then 2014 with you involved again. We all know. You didn't discover in 2014 that the settlements are the biggest obstacles to peace. Given that you all know that, and yet you're still reluctant to push that lever, it just creates the impression that for you, the process is more important than the peace, and therefore you are constantly undermining the peace.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism. What happened in 2014 was that John Kerry, through a Herculean effort, managed to get the parties back to the negotiating table. Unfortunately, the only way he was able to do that was to work out a deal in which there was 9 months of negotiations in exchange for 4 tranches of prisoner releases. That's what the Palestinians chose. There was a second door, which was a settlement freeze, and they didn't insist on that at the time. They went for a prisoner deal.
Well, they didn't expect Netanyahu to expand settlements every time he released a prisoner.
But we need to focus on this program, and he said that.
Yeah.
He did it for the prisoners.
I know.
But the problem was there was no agreement to stop the settlement.
You should tell
and
that.
It was the settlements that screwed up the negotiations.
It was the settlements that screwed up the negotiations. You admit that. Okay.
It's not an admission. It is a charge.
Okay.
It was a major problem.
Fine. Martin Indyk, you've said in the past that you shared Bill Clinton's view on Middle East peacemaking, that it was better to try and fail than not to try at all. Given you've tried and failed under both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, do you personally still hold that view?
Yes, and I will never give up. It's a Churchillian dictum, never, ever, ever, ever give up. And why? It's because it is better to try and fail than not to try at all.
We're going to have to take a break there. In part two, we're going to talk about the US-Israeli relationship and what's behind that relationship. Head-to-head, we'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Head-to-Head on Al Jazeera English. My guest here in the Oxford Union is Martin Indyk, former US ambassador to Israel. Martin, there are many competing theories as to why the United States government is so pro-Israel. Some say it's because of shared values. Others say it's due to strategic interests. Others say it's because of the power and influence of pro-Israeli lobbying organizations in Washington, D.C. I just want to ask you first about the strategic argument. General David Petraeus, former director of the CIA, has said that the Israel-Palestine conflict foments anti-American sentiment. Even the late Meir Dagan, who was head of Mossad of Israeli intelligence, has said, quote, Israel is gradually turning from an asset to the United States into a burden. Do you agree with them?
No, I don't agree with that. I think that Israel, particularly in its relationship now with Egypt and with Jordan, is working in a common strategic interest to deal with threats in the region beyond the issue of Palestine. But I do believe that making progress on the Palestinian issue enhances America's credibility in the region, and failing to make progress on the Palestinian issue hurts America's credibility in the region.
And what about the power and influence of pro-Israeli lobbying organizations in D.C. like AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which you worked for briefly in the 1980s? Would you say it's all a conspiracy theory? It's all anti-Semitism to talk about the power of lobbying organizations? Or would you say, no, actually, they do put a straitjacket on U.S. governments and hinder interests of the U.S. in the region?
AIPAC is indeed a powerful lobby on behalf of Israel. There's no doubt that its influence constrains what an administration can consider that it would do.
You said in 2006 the lobby at Congress has put a straitjacket on administrations in a way that has not been productive for American interests.
That's me?
That is you.
I don't recognize that.
At the London Review of Books debate. Okay. You've also said, and I hope you recognize this one, that you've taken a lot of heat from the Israel lobby and you have the scars to show for it.
Correct.
Thereby accepting that the pro-Israeli organizations play a detrimental and powerful role in this process.
I didn't say detrimental. I think that...
Well, if you're working for peace and they're scarring your back then are they not detrimental?
Peacemaking is a blood sport. When you're in the arena, you inevitably face criticism. You know, precisely because I'm seen to have come from the pro-Israel community, there is an expectation that all I will do will represent Israel's interests. And my answer is no. I'm there to represent America's interests in making peace, which I happen to believe also serves Israel's interests. But some of them don't agree.
Listen to Zev Sternhell, award-winning Israeli intellectual, self-proclaimed super Zionist. He says AIPAC's role is absolutely disastrous because it prevents any possibility to move with the Palestinians. We cannot move without American intervention, but we are more or less free of American intervention. This is AIPAC's job, to give the Israeli government a sentiment of impunity.
AIPAC is caught in a kind of bind here because, even though, as I say, they represent the pro-Israel community in the United States, they also adhere to the policies of the Israeli government. And as a result, they're caught often in a situation, especially when there's tension or confrontation between an Israeli government, usually a right-wing government, but not always, and an American administration.
You say they're aligned with Israeli government views, except they don't actually represent American Jewish opinion all that often when it comes to Israel-Palestine, who are much more dovish, use a phrase.
There were 18,000 pro-Israelis at the AIPAC conference. That was a pretty strong expression of representation there and then. But yes, there are others in the Jewish community that don't agree with the kind of Kool-Aid test that AIPAC presents.
Okay, and one last question before we go to our panel. You've been associated with, you've spoken at J Street, which was founded in 2009 as a kind of progressive counterweight to AIPAC. In 2014, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations voted not to admit J Street into their umbrella group because, in the words of one Orthodox leader, its positions are out of the mainstream of what could be considered acceptable. The conservative American Jewish establishment has shut down progressive Jewish voices on this issue time and again, hasn't it, in the United States?
Yeah, and I think they've made a huge mistake in doing so. They've actually boosted J Street dramatically. It's been totally counterproductive. But J Street needs to be part of the dialogue. It is. It's made itself part of the dialogue, precisely because they are pro-Israel and pro-peace. And that's critically important. It's especially important for a younger generation in the American Jewish community who need to be able to support Israel in a way that makes sense to them. And J Street has a way to reach them in a way that AIPAC has great difficulty doing.
Let's go back to our panel. Garda Carmi is a British-Palestinian activist, author of a recent memoir, Return. Garda Carmi, there's no pro-Palestinian version of AIPAC. Is that why the Palestinians are not getting their voices heard, in your view, in the US?
No, but it's one of the factors. There's no doubt that if there were a Palestinian organization or pro-Palestinians that was funded so heavily as the other side is, that it would help. But I don't believe that that's the central problem here. You have a vicious circle in which Israel rampages around the region, rampages against the Palestinians, and nobody does anything to stop it.
Where is Israel rampaging around the region now?
Oh, really? So you think being in occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights, bombing Lebanon, still being in occupation of part of Lebanon, bombing Gaza,
you brought up Syria,
you think that's not rampaging?
There you had five Israeli prime ministers who was involved in this, all offered the regime of Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad full withdrawal from the Golan Heights, all of them. And it comes back to the Palestinians. We had Barak and Olmert offering the Palestinians 95% to 97% of the West Bank and all of Gaza, and they didn't take it.
Do you know
there are two sides to every story.
Oh, yes.
It's not just Israel's fault.
Yes, but please. I'm glad you've got lots of friends here. But what I wanted to say to you is rather like, you know, you steal my wallet, which has, let's say, $100 in it, and then I come along and say, let's come to an agreement about this, and you say, fine, I'm going to offer you $60. I'll keep the $40. Now, aren't I generous?
Actually, you have more friends than I have in the audience. But it's, look, if you cannot be satisfied, it's fine. It's fine. I understand
we
it.
Don't have
but if
anything.
You can't be satisfied with 95 to 97% of the West Bank
where
and all of
it?
Gaza, then we cannot have a two-state solution.
Because we don't have time, we can't get into this. But your 95-97, you know, is questioned by many Israelis, many Palestinians, many Americans.
I was there.
Okay.
I was there.
There were people who were there also who disagreed with you.
No,
they happen to be called Palestinians.
Look, it's easy to make fun of this.
I'm not making fun of it. You said you were there.
There
I'm just saying.
In terms of what Clinton offered them.
And both sides tabled reservations to the Clinton parameters in December 2000, as you well know.
No. Barack accepted them.
That's not true, but we'll have to agree to disagree on
that. Excuse me. I was there.
Okay.
When the facts came from Barack's office to my residence in Israel with the formal decision signed by the Prime Minister accepting the Clinton parameters. So don't tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Alan Johnson. Alan Johnson was a professor of democratic theory before joining BICOM, the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre, as a senior research fellow. Alan, you work for what's called by some of your critics Britain's pro-Israel lobby. Surely you wouldn't dispute that groups such as AIPAC in the United States do exercise a lot of power and influence, and sometimes, many times, in a way that prevents the making of peace in the Middle East.
I think it would be ridiculous to say that AIPAC didn't exercise significant influence. I think, though, it's vastly overstated, and the proof of that was that when Barack Obama wanted to drive through the P5 plus one Iran nuclear deal, it had no impact. I mean, one other point, there's a common sense amongst people which I think is some distance from where AIPAC is, and I think we saw that most clearly with their treatment and reception of Donald Trump at their recent conference. I mean, the hooping and the hollering and the cheering of Donald Trump I thought was appalling, and for two reasons. One, who Trump is. Trump is the most foremost American anti-Muslim bigot. He's a misogynist and he's a xenophobe. And secondly, for who AIPAC is, which it will be seen by many Jews and many non-Jews as they'll be estranged from the pro-Israel case because they're liberals, they're Democrats, and they have very different values to that. Huge mistake.
Rachel Sharby is an award-winning British journalist, Iraqi Jewish heritage, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Martin was saying he doesn't think that Israel is a strategic burden to the United States. Many have argued it's an asset in some ways. Where do you stand on that debate now?
First of all, just because we're falling into this dynamic of being very partisan and intractable conflict, actually it is perfectly possible to want peace and justice for both Israelis and Palestinians. Please let's not lose sight of that. That position exists. It's perfectly tenable. Secondly, I disagree with you, Rada. I don't think that the US is unable to make Israel exercise restraint. I think it's unwilling to do it because Israel is a strategic asset. You pretend to be about peace and democracy in the region. And, you know, it just creates mammoth problems. I mean, that is the bit that's problematic. Okay. That is the bit that is seen as hypocritical.
Let Martin come back in
and
then we go to the audience.
Look, I don't think that anybody is under any illusion that the United States is in Israel's corner. We don't hide that. We say it. We shout it from the rooftops.
So why does John Kerry say we can be an honest broker then?
Well, because the two are not inconsistent. I know this is hard.
It is very hard to admit. Very hard
to admit. But the two are not inconsistent because it's an attempt to try to listen to both sides, figure out what their basic needs are, and come forward with a plan that would be acceptable to both sides.
Okay. Let's go to our audience who've been waiting patiently here in the Oxford Union. Let's take the gentleman in the glasses in the third row.
As a human rights lawyer in the past in Israel, I feel that I cannot raise my family in Israel. And indirectly, because of America's support of Israel, Israel is no longer a viable democracy, one that is currently, and over the past 5-6 years, is constantly in conflict between its Jewish identity and its democratic identity. And while America challenges almost every country in the world in terms of protection of human rights, it does not do that. And human rights organizations are currently under constant threat, and America says nothing about that. Thank you.
Well, first of all, that's not true. If you go and look on the State Department website at the latest human rights report on Israel, you will see some pretty harsh criticism of Israeli actions in the West Bank. And if you go back through the years, you will see very harsh criticism. That said,
It is a democracy. And it's a shame for Israel that you had to leave, because you need to be there. And all of these NGOs that are under attack there need to be defended. And the United States will stand up for them. And the United States is telling the Israeli government, we will oppose that kind of legislation that some of your Knesset members are trying to pass.
But when you say, we don't agree with what you're doing, and they say, who cares, what do you do about it?
If you're talking about cutting aid, if that's what you're talking about, is yes, I can imagine that some circumstances would arise. That has happened before, and I don't rule it out that it would happen in the future.
Let's go back to our audience. Let's go to the gentleman here in the second row, and then I want to go to the back.
My granddad left Palestine to Lebanon in 1947. And so my question to you is, how can you justify denying Palestinians' right of return as a precondition to peace whilst abetting settlers to live in Israel?
Look, Palestinian refugees need to have a solution to their problem and to their suffering. But it cannot come at the expense of Israel's existence. And so the two have to be reconciled. There is a way of reconciling them. It's in the Clinton parameters, to give the Palestinians a right of return to Palestine and a choice about other places where they could go, including Israel. And plus compensation for their suffering. And that package of a solution for the Palestinian refugees is going to have to be part of a final status agreement that ends the claims as well as ending the conflict.
Okay, let's go back to our audience. Let's go to someone at the back.
My question is, how do you justify thousands of American Jewish, like, young teenagers join the Israeli army every year? Because I have paid a visit to Jerusalem, and then I met several of them, and they are over-idealized on this holy war. Sometimes I felt like, how is that different from, like, the British jihadists over-idealized their holy war as well?
First of all, American Jews can become Israelis, join the Israel Defense Forces. They have to operate under Israeli Defense Force regulations. And as far as I know, those regulations don't provide for holy jihad. But I think that there are some American Jews who are settlers, who are ideologues. And as I said before, that kind of approach, which is designed to take the West Bank because that's the land that God gave to Israel, is an approach that is against a two-state solution, and therefore I am against it.
Okay, let's go back to the audience. Gentleman here in the second row in the suit.
As an Israeli, I feel very privileged to be living at a time that the Jewish people, for the first time in around 2,000 years, do have the ability to defend themselves. So it's understood why it's expected that Israel makes concessions more than others. But from my experience working with peace groups and Palestinians in the West Bank, they have never taken responsibility or agreed that they need to make concessions themselves. Terror have started from the 1920s, before there were any settlements, okay, to this day. What do you think the concessions that the Palestinians need to do, if they even need to do any concessions?
Briefly.
You know, I think it's not accurate to say the Palestinians have made no concessions. The Palestinian Authority leadership in the PLO have accepted to live side by side with Israel. That is an historic compromise in which they're only claiming, 40% of historic Palestine.
22%.
22%, sorry.
Much lower.
That's number one. Number two, they have accepted that there should be land swaps. And land swaps would enable Israel to absorb some 75 to 80% of the settlers who live in 6% of the West Bank, provided that Israel provides 6% of Israel proper for the Palestinians.
Can we go to the lady right at the back? Yes.
I just wanted to ask you, why do you think is it okay for Israel to have a covert nuclear bomb, but not for Iran?
An Iran with nuclear weapons threatening to destroy
Israel would trigger a nuclear arms race if not an Israeli attack on Iran. And that's why the
United
States...
Do you not think Israel having nukes triggers a regional arms race?
Well, you know, if Israel has nukes...
Oh, if. Do they not have nukes?
If.
Does Israel not have nukes?
If Israel has nukes, what's interesting, there's a widespread assumption that Israel has nuclear weapons. It has not triggered an arms race in the region.
Do you share that assumption, that Israel has nuclear weapons?
The Egyptians...
I know Israeli policy is not to admit to nuclear
any
weapons.
Of
You're not an Israeli. Can you tell me if they have nuclear weapons? Oh,
enjoy yourself, Mehdi. I'm not going to answer your question.
Why?
Well, because, you know, it's an issue which I, as a government official, former government official...
A U.S. government official, not Israeli government official. Why can't the U.S. government say if Israel has nukes on it?
I'm going to opine on it. The issue is whether Israel threatens the region. None of the Arabs around Israel consider that Israel's capabilities present a threat to them. They do consider that Iran's nuclear capability presents a threat.
Let's go to this gentleman in the beard.
Israel has broken 65 UN resolutions. Iraq broke two and was invaded, destroyed, and bombed. Why are there such double standards in dealing with countries who violate United Nations resolutions?
I seem to be put in this role where I'm supposed to be defending Israel. I'd rather defend the United States.
I don't think he asked about Israel. He asked about Iraq. America invaded Iraq. I think he's making the point that the United States invaded Iraq for defying 22 UN resolutions, and Israel's defied lots of resolutions, and it doesn't even it might get an abstention.
We should invade Israel.
No, not invade, but how do you explain the double standards in terms of treatment of countries and international law?
The double standards argument is an argument that is used by Israel and by critics of Israel. So, you know, I don't find it's a particularly productive way of dealing with the problems. The United States, yes, we have double standards. It's true. We have double standards. We do our best to try to be consistent. But it's not always simple. This is, you know, it's simple to do it at the Oxford Union. But it's not always simple when you're in government. When you've got to weigh different interests, one of which is a very important human rights standard. As Americans, that is important.
Okay.
But there are a lot of other interests at stake too, and sometimes the balance doesn't come out. It's the province of powers to be righteous, Sweden, for instance.
You made the point. Last question, gentleman here in the jacket.
I worked as a UN medical officer in Gaza for a couple of years. In 2014, the Wafa Rehabilitation Hospital, four substantial buildings, was razed by Israeli attacks with U.S. arms. Now, that same year, as you know already, a lot of civilians were killed, again, with U.S. arms. Three that meant a great deal to our family was a woman who was 8 months pregnant, and her three-year-old child and six-year-old child. Now, those two children were two of over 500 children that were killed during that assault. They were good friends of ours. They are no longer. The family was destroyed. The U.S. continues to arm Israel with state-of-the-art weaponry to the teeth. Can the U.S. justify, in the light of the use of those arms against medical facilities and women and children, on the scale that it continues to provide them?
First of all, on a personal level, I just say that the killing of innocent children is unacceptable by anybody here. I'm not trying to put it as a justification, but I am trying to put it in context. That Israeli civilians were coming under attack by Hamas rockets. It ended up to be thousands of them. But I'm not presenting it as an excuse, okay? I hope you will understand that. It's not acceptable that children die. But when Hamas hides its rockets in civilian areas, purposely doing so,
in order that when Israel comes to try to destroy the rockets, it kills Gazan children.
Okay, Martha.
That creates a circumstance in which Hamas also needs to take responsibility.
One final question. We're running out of time. You were at the heart of the U.S.-led peace process under both Presidents Clinton and Obama. You've been a special envoy, a senior State Department official, a U.S. ambassador to Israel. Given that process has clearly failed, whatever happens in the future, as of now, has failed, there is no peace, there is no process, do you feel personally responsible for that failure in any way?
Yes.
And what can you do about that now?
What do you want from me, baby?
Well,
okay, all I can do...
Serious note, you went back in 2013.
I can do...
Would you go back again?
Until I draw my last breath, I will not give up on trying to resolve this conflict in a way that meets Palestinian legitimate national aspirations to an independent and viable, contiguous state living alongside Israel, Jewish state, in peace.
Martin Indyk, on that note, thank you for joining me.
That was a recording of the Al Jazeera program Head to Head with Mehdi Hassan, featuring guest Martin Indyk.
I was sent to Eton, school for scoundrels. Inequality was built into the whole structure of Eton. I left thinking that I was a superior human being.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A 100 years ago, the Battle of the Somme was raging, killed nearly a million men. So why, when the Germans sued for peace, did Britain say no? Well, Michael Gove called it a just war, one of the most pointless mass human sacrifices in history. The Somme saw the first ever use of tanks by the British Army. There were over a million British, German and French casualties. Germany sued for peace in October 1916, just about 100 years ago this week. And the Battle of the Somme ended inconclusively by November 1916. But tonight we take a look at that peace effort and ask why the military commander Lord Haig and the British government of the day said no and carried on with another 2 years of slaughter. Also, Israeli Independence Day really divides the Jews. Some think it's a celebration, but for others it's the Nakba Day, a day of mourning. We hear from the Orthodox London Jews who believe the Israeli state is not Jewish at all. And have the Egyptian state media been listening to this show? They say 9/11 was made up to justify the war on terror, and we say they're right. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. We feature this week. He was educated at Eton. He's the black sheep of the Guinness family, David Guinness again. This week talking about whatever happened to British engineering. And he should know, he was an engineer himself that was headhunted to work on the space program in the United States. But first, Martin, this week, over to Syria. We have to start here because it's been a horrendous week with the breaking of the ceasefire.
Well, the ceasefire was obviously in a fairly, very difficult to enforce anyway. But of course,
but we had an attack on Syrian troops, killing about 60 or 80 of them last weekend.
Yes, indeed, including
this attack on the aid convoy,
including by an RAF drone, of course. So in other words, all those Labour MPs who voted for the RAF to be bombing ISIS inside Syria, not Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters, obviously, the people like Hillary Benn and the Tory party, that ends up with 60 to 80 dead Syrian soldiers. And then the US comes out, the Russians call a UN Security Council meeting. The Americans are really angry. The Samantha Power turns up to the meeting but doesn't go into the meeting. She just goes outside the meeting to talk to journalists and says, well, it was just an accident. Well, what are they on about? And I, of course, both the Russians and the Syrians think it's not an accident. This is a deliberate thing that you've done here. ISIS attacked the Syrian army unit that you bombed, and they were bombing them for over 20 minutes, and then ISIS immediately attacked as soon as they bombed, including the RAF. Had finished killing those people.
Well, look, let me just correct you, because you did say that the Tory party voted for the air war in Syria, and actually there were some Tory MPs...
Some Tory MPs, to their credit, voted against. But those who voted for have all voted for us. Basically, if the Syrians were to interpret this as an act of war, then we're at war with Syria. And it could be, for example, that the RAF Waddington, where they fly those drones, some Syrian commander might say, right, what we need to do about that is we need to get to RAF Waddington and kill some RAF personnel. Maybe 60. 60 of yours, 60 of ours.
Well, surely ISIS might say the same. What was the difference between
ISIS, according to what the Syrians are saying, what the Iranians are saying, what the Russian general staff are saying, they're saying that you support ISIS. There was a similar attack by an American airstrike on Iraqi army forces that were actually closing in on Mosul. They killed over 100 of them. And, of course, the Iraqi government, which is generally Shia-led, are also of the opinion that Britain and America are, in fact, supporting ISIS. And, in fact, we know, don't we, that Turkey supports ISIS, Qatar supports ISIS, Saudi Arabia supports ISIS. They're our allies. And the Russians' general staff and the Syrian general staff and the Iranian general staff have they've pretty much made their minds up about this. And I think they're right. We are supporting ISIS. And this is the reality. And we pretend that we're bombing Syria to get ISIS, and in actual fact, we're using ISIS to try and overthrow Assad and use them as a kind of a fox that allows us to chase in there and do what we want.
The British and the Americans and the Danes have admitted to being part of this attack on the Syrian army, the Syrian Arab army.
Can I just mention about the Syrian Arab army? They've taken 60,000 casualties in the last 4 years. 60,000 casualties fighting Islamic extremists, including ISIS. When is the British Army going to take 60,000 casualties and carry on fighting?
Of course, the possibility is that those people involved in these RAF drone strikes might actually have been Americans, because we're not quite sure what happens inside these so-called US bases. The RAF Waddington, there's loads of USAF personnel at RAF Waddington.
Indeed. So somebody sitting in RAF Waddington with the imprimatur of the British government on it, whether it's an American citizen or a British citizen, was involved in the killing of 60 Syrian army soldiers. And that's 60,000 plus 60
We do know who conducted that attack, but there's a bit of a mystery around the attack on the aid convoy a couple of days later. I think it was Monday.
Yeah, well, I've been looking at this, and the Russians have said, look, we didn't have any aircraft in the area. You did have a drone in the area. We had a drone in the area. They showed photographs of the trucks with a rebel mortar being towed along by the trucks. And if you actually look at the pictures...
An aid convoy with a mortar in tow.
Indeed. And that's why the Russians are saying, look, there's a mortar in the middle of the aid convoy. It's just, it's a rebel aid convoy.
In which case, maybe it was the Russians then, because said, well, you can't have this because it's not an aid convoy, it's got a mortar involved.
What the Russians are saying is they want a full investigation, but they're pointing out, if you look at the photographs, there's evidence that the trucks caught fire. There's definite evidence of that. There's no evidence that they were hit by bombs. There's no craters. There's nothing like that. There's just evidence of fire. And, of course, given the way that the rebels work with their handlers in MI6, CIA, etc., they're quite capable of attacking the convoy and then saying the Russians did it. They're quite capable of doing that. The rebels could probably think of doing something like that on their own. And the white helmets just happen to be there to film it all. Those famous white helmets, which are funded by your taxes, folks. But they're actually embedded with the Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda Syria. And, of course, they are working with British special forces, etc.
So, anyway, the long and short of it is complete breakdown in the ceasefire, although, of course, it has allowed a little bit of aid into Aleppo to help any civilians who are left there.
Can I just mention that Aleppo is it's only the eastern part of Aleppo. The majority of the population in Aleppo is under government control. And they're basically, the rebels are using the people in the bit they control as human shields. That's what's going on. And they said, we don't want a ceasefire anyway.
I mean, in order to get a bit of balance of this, I went to have a look at the FARS news agency. That's F-A-R-S news agency, based in Iran. And what they're saying is 30 Israeli foreign intelligence officers were killed in Russia's caliber missile attack in Aleppo. So this is part of the attack on the rebel-held areas of Aleppo. And yet, apparently, there was a bunker with 30 Israeli and other national foreign intelligence officers in there.
Well, that's what the Iranians are saying. Whether it's true, you can make up your own. What people need to realise is we need to hear what everybody's saying. The Iranians are saying that Israeli military personnel were killed inside Aleppo. Now, I can believe that. It's perfectly feasible. Okay. We know that Israelis,
rather than
the
just
Turks,
rather than just the headlines, let's have a look at the going into a bit of detail here. Russian warship stationed in Syria's coastal waters, says FARS News, targeted and destroyed a foreign military operations room, killing over 24 Israeli and Western intelligence officers. The Russian warships fired 3 caliber missiles at the foreign officers' coordination operation room in Dar Ezzer region in the western part of Aleppo near Saman Mountain, killing 30 Israeli and Western officers. The Arabic language service of Russia's Sputnik news agency quoted battlefield source in Aleppo on Wednesday this week. The operations room was located in the western part of Aleppo province, in the middle of sky-high Saman Mountains and in old caves. The region is deep into a chain of mountains. Several US, Turkish, Saudi, Qatari and British officers were also killed, along with the Israeli officers.
Well, I hear what they say. I don't necessarily believe anything I hear, but it's quite likely that, for example, British military personnel have been killed inside Syria, but we haven't heard about it because they're not supposed to be there, basically. They've got no legal basis to be there. If there are British military personnel in Syria and they get killed by the Syrian army, well, I'm afraid that's not murder. That's just, you shouldn't be there. And if you get killed, that's just too bad, isn't it?
Some of the other latest headlines from Syria, they have announced an offensive now as the truce talks fail. That's the Assad government based, of course, in Damascus. And also Turkey won't join Raqqa invasion if the Kurds are involved. So the Kurds and the Turks are falling out as to whether they're really going to take on the rebels and ISIS. Also, Russia has rejected John Kerry, the US Secretary of State's demand to ground all planes in Syria. Now, I think what they're saying is, look, whilst this aid is being moved around, let's just say we don't want any aircraft at all in Syria. Oh, that's what John Kerry is proposing.
Well, the ceasefire has broken down because the rebels won't accept it. And they haven't. And eventually, after several days of the Syrian army trying to have a ceasefire with them, they just weren't prepared to have a ceasefire. Then the NATO air forces come over the border and kill 60 Syrian soldiers. And at that point, they say, "Well, there is no ceasefire." I think the purpose of having a ceasefire from the Syrian government and Russian position is to demonstrate we are prepared to have a ceasefire. It's them that's not prepared to have a ceasefire. And if I was in charge in Damascus, I would say, "Right, let's get this absolutely clear. You are not to fly your planes into Syrian airspace, whether you're Turkish, whoever you are, Danish, American, whoever you are. We've got SS-300 air defence systems here from the Russians. Let's just shoot you down." So if people want a war with Syria, they can have a war with Syria, and that means dead RAF pilots.
Another part of this, Martin, of course, is we heard back in last month that the Chinese are stepping up their military cooperation with Assad. One of their top admirals visited Damascus, and the media reported back in August a signal of growing concern in Beijing about the course of the civil war. Rear Admiral Guan Yufei, he heads China's Office for International Military Cooperation, met Lieutenant General Fahad Jassim, who's the Syrian Defence Minister, and they are willing to, they say, to strengthen cooperation bring their advisers in. Now, effectively, what's happening is Syria is turning into a kind of microcosm of this great superpower war that's going on in the outside world. There's economic warfare, there's trade barriers being put up, for example, with the Russians, etc. But it all seems to be focused on the ground in Syria.
it is. And, you know, at any moment, you could have a situation where a British plane is shot down by the Russians or vice versa, and World War III could kick off. And people have got to realise if that's where we're going, that's where we're going. If they really want to keep intervening in Syria, you will eventually cross a tripwire, and we will be at war with Russia. And that means, for example, that if RAF planes flying over Syria will be shot down.
Well, it's only a drone, so it won't actually kill anybody, will it?
Obviously, if you're dealing with drones, then you have to find out where the drones are being flown from and kill the people there, don't you? If there's a war on, then that's it, then it's a war. Come on, let's not pussyfoot around here. If people want a war, let's have one. But, of course, hopefully, if we do get to that point, the Syrians and the Russians will thrash the people that are trying to overthrow the government.
So are there people within our government, the Ministry of Defence and our military that want a war, do you think?
Well, I think what's going on is that the Pentagon are not happy with this whole ceasefire discussion thing that Kerry and Obama are pushing, which is why they probably killed the Syrian soldiers to kill off the ceasefire. And General Dunford, who's the US commander, said, well, people shouldn't presume that that was an accident when we killed those soldiers, you know. And you know what? It probably wasn't an accident. Somebody wants a war. But, of course, people got to be careful who wish for a war. They may get what they wish for. And you know what? It will be very interesting to see when the Battle of Syria is fought, like the Battle of Britain, with Russian air defences trying to take on NATO. In the past, NATO just presumed that they would have air superiority. I think it's going to be very interesting. If it comes to a proper air battle, it may very well be that NATO will lose air superiority over the whole Middle East if they really want to. If they really
want
to go to war with
Russia. Still got their satellites, Martin, even higher up.
Well, it doesn't matter. They can be shot down as well, can't they?
One of the interesting aspects of this is one could consider it as a way that the Russians and NATO are almost looking at what the other side is capable of in Syria with a view to a wider war.
Indeed, and what the Russians have been doing is quietly showing the NATO forces that they haven't got superiority. The capabilities of the Russian in electronic warfare, etc., are actually very, very, very high. And if it comes to a straight fight between NATO air forces and the Russian air force, I wouldn't bet on the NATO air forces winning.
Also, I was looking at this earlier on in the week. We discussed it, I think, maybe once or twice on here before. But ISIS have come up with some amazing reasons as to why they don't attack Israel, even though, of course, they're quite capable of doing that, being in Syria right next door to Israel. Excuse me. Martin, why do you think, and what are the official statements from ISIS saying about why Israel is not one of their targets? I mean, ideologically, if you look at all their propaganda, the Israelis, the Zionist state, is the enemy, and yet they're not interested in fighting with them, it seems. It's anybody else, almost.
Well, that's because ISIS, Al-Nusra Front, and all the other groups, are basically being run by Western intelligence services.
But, okay, we've heard that before from you again and again, but what reason do ISIS come up with as to why they're not...
Well, the reason ISIS... the ostensible reason is that they think that they've got to get rid of all of the unbelieving Muslims first. So the Shia, the Christians, they've got to clean out the Muslim house before they go on to take on the Zionist state.
So does that mean going through places like Iran? And getting rid of anybody that doesn't agree with ISIS in Iran?
Ultimately, the ideology of ISIS as it's been presented is that they want to kill all unbelievers.
Just a minute. So ISIS is actually more targeting Islamic countries than it is, say Israel, which they're supposed to be against.
Well, that's because it is effectively a tool of intelligence services, like the Saudis. And the Saudis and the Israelis are very, very close.
Hang on. ISIS issues its own statements, for example.
Yes, I know, but I mean...
They issue their own videos, for example. How can you say that this is being done by the West?
Well, in actual fact, it'd be very interesting to know where the funding comes from to create these videos and so on. The Russians are...
It comes from oil. They're selling oil.
Yeah, they're selling oil, but you know how they sell the oil? They drive it in trucks into Turkey, and then the Turkish government sells the oil onto the Israelis on the black market, and that creates cash which allows ISIS to function, because the Turkish government allows it to function. And when the Russians started bombing the convoys that took the oil out of Syria, the Turks went mad, because it was what are you doing, you're bombing, the evidence that shows that the Western intelligence services and the Western powers are behind ISIS after 4 years of war is pretty much overwhelming. I know most people think, we're fighting ISIS, aren't we? We're against ISIS. No, we're not. We're not against ISIS. It's all a game. So ISIS is being allowed to operate. There's a senior Israeli military figure the other week was just saying, well, we shouldn't get rid of ISIS. They're really useful. And, you know, he's coming straight out and saying it. And, of course, you can be quite sure that the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff and the Syrian general staff know exactly what they're up against. But they're fighting ISIS, okay, backed by Western military,
forces. What did the British general staff know about this?
Well, the British general staff are split down the middle, as far as I can see. There's some people who talk a bit of common sense, and then there's other people just talking rubbish.
And what about the United States? Because we've had General Michael Flynn. He was the head of the, not of the NSA, what was it? The Defence Intelligence, the DIA, Defence Intelligence Agency. He was saying that it was a willful creation of the US military and the US politicians.
Yeah, well, both he and General Dempsey were resigned, pushed out of the US military because they said, well, we don't really agree with. I mean, Dempsey's saying, well, actually, what I was doing when I was head of the army is I was basically helping out the Syrian regime with intelligence and so on because I don't agree with the White House's policy of supporting ISIS. But, I mean, it's out there in the open. We've got two US generals telling us, yes, we do support ISIS. And we do. We do support ISIS. And then we say, oh, we've got to stop ISIS. No, that's why we're killing the Syrian army.
We haven't heard that much about that story on the BBC. Another one we haven't heard much about is the 9/11, what really happened on the September the 11th attacks, because Egyptian state media this week has claimed that ISIS is made up and 9/11 was carried out by the West to justify the war on terror. ISIS could have been invented by the US to justify the devastation, partitioning and occupation of the Middle East. So a columnist for a state-run newspaper in Egypt, that is, saying that. Is it possible to believe the official version from the US government of the events of September the 11th, 2001, wrote journalist Noha al-Shanobi in Al-Hahram, a major national Egyptian newspaper owned by the government. She said that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon attacks could have been premeditated to justify the war on terror. And a column published at the end of August, this has really only recently been translated into English, she also cast doubts over the veracity of the actions of the so-called Islamic State, alleging the extremist group could have been made up to trick the world and validate US foreign policy. She doesn't appear to shy away from controversial subjects. Her weekly column recently discussed issues such as burkini bans, French military involvement in Libya, and whether it's acceptable to sacrifice chickens, ducks and geese.
Well, I mean, the dogs in the street in the Middle East know that the Western intelligence services are terrorists. It's as simple as that. It couldn't be plainer. It's as simple as that. The so-called Islamic extremists are largely funded, armed and trained by the Western powers and their Gulf state allies. Everybody knows that. And ultimately, it's going to lead to world war.
Oh, thank you, Martin. That's a cheerful thing.
Well, I'm afraid it is, isn't it? You can't really. We're right on the cusp of it.
I don't necessarily agree with you. A bit like your stuff that you say with the crash that's absolutely inevitable. All the time that there is even small advances being made in this kind of low intensity war, then surely the powers that be are going to be happy with that.
Well, yes, what they want is, like in 1984, is continuous war so that they can carry on spending money on weaponry. That's what the game really is.
And meanwhile, of course, our civil liberties are being taken away. And we mentioned drones earlier.
Well, our civil liberties are also being taken away by the terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center, and they weren't actually, they weren't working, you know, they weren't ISIS.
The ISIS weren't around. Drones will stay in the air for weeks and track whole populations, says Edward Snowden. Solar-powered drones will stay in the air for weeks, tracking the movements not just of individuals but of whole populations, the NSA whistleblower wrote in an article published back in May this year. Making drones more persistent is a capability which the US has been pursuing forever, Snowden wrote in The Intercept, which, of course, is a great place. I mean, you should have it bookmarked on your computer. Have a look at that website from Brazil. Loads of brilliant stuff coming out there. Of course, it's one of the main places which is leaking the Snowden material. The goal is to deploy solar-powered drones that can loiter in the air for weeks without coming down. Once you can do that, you can put any typical signals collection device on the bottom of it to monitor unblinkingly the emanations of, for example, a different network of addresses of every laptop, smartphone and iPod. You know not just where a particular device is, in what city, but you know what apartment each device lives in, where it goes at any particular time and by what route, he explained. When such surveillance extends to at least several cities. The security agencies harness the ability to track the movements not just of individuals but of whole populations. Now, Martin, this does remind me, this obsession with collecting a kind of mass database and profiling of the entire population of planet Earth, exactly what the Nazis were doing in the 1930s.
Yeah, with much less advanced technology. But, of course, this technology is double-edged. As you were speaking there, I was just remembering what happened with the Hariri assassination in Lebanon, where Hezbollah hacked into Israeli drones. They were saying that Hariri wasn't killed by a car bomb by us, or a suicide bomb by us. He was killed by an Israeli drone. And then they gave a press conference where they showed the video footage from the Israeli drone because they'd hacked into it. So if you've got a drone that's flying over Syria, say, and getting loads of information, you know, a NATO drone, it's quite feasible for the Syrian or the Russians to just hack into that drone and take control
of
it.
Well, this is a kind of dystopic future that they're painting, isn't it? And you're painting here, because I know you're absolutely right. Back in 2004, I think it was, when the Shia insurgency started in Iraq, that was caused because of a shutdown of a newspaper, the Al-Sadr newspaper, when Paul Bremer just decided to send the boys around in the Humvees and close this place down and padlock it up, which had been the main organ for the Shia population in Iraq, just closing down a newspaper, just like that. This is what these guys do. And the reason they'd done that is because the previous edition had on its front page a whole load of witness testimony that so-called suicide bombing hadn't been anything of the sort. It had been a drone attack. And these missiles come in so fast from these drones, you don't get any kind of warning. You just hear an explosion and nobody really knows where that explosion has come from.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is all ongoing, isn't it? But as I say, it's double-edged. It could very well be, if we get into an air war over Syria, that we will find out what Russian capabilities really are, because I think they're quite capable of taking over NATO drones. So NATO's got all this fancy kit. I mean, the Snowden case itself is also fascinating. Some low-level guy in the bureaucracy, some subcontractor, goes into work with an MP3, and he's got all of the information that the NSA's been collecting on everybody, just like that. Just think how leaky these systems actually are.
It's like an iPod or something, just a little memory stick.
That's right. All of these clever electronic systems that NATO very much depends on, what the Russians have been developing is electronic countermeasures. We just knock out all the electronics.
I was fuming the week before last because of this leak to do with Menwith Hill, which wasn't reported by a single London newspaper. Very important information about the targeting for these illegal drone killings around the world being done from Yorkshire, from Menwith Hill. And it's extremely frustrating that these leaks are not being reported. So I thought I'd go back and find a recent talk by Edward Snowden. He does these kind of live link-ups with all sorts of groups in the Western world. Maybe we should put a request in to get him on this show. But in this particular clip, he talks about the way that what he witnessed at the National Security Agency and as a private contractor at Booz Hamilton and various other organisations, including the CIA he worked for, because he'd come from a military family. He said that effectively, this is a network to close down basic things like having freedom of association. So when a group gets together, maybe a little group like ACORN here in Bristol to help defend evictions, there is a possibility now of closing that network down, putting them under surveillance, finding out who the key people are, and destabilising them or removing them in one way or another. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Edward Snowden, one of his recent talks.
My grandfather was in the military, my father was in the military, my mother still works for the government, my sister works for the government, and I worked for the government. I was a staff officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. I had signed up to join the U.S. military in the wake of the September 11th attacks. I actually signed up for the invasion of Iraq because I believed that fundamentally our government had noble intents, and it did good things, and it did them for the right reasons. What I was not aware of, and I've grown to become a little more sophisticated in this, is that while the people in government largely are exactly that, they're good people trying to do good things for the right reasons, there is a culture that sort of pervades the upper levels of government, the senior officials, political appointees, that have become less accountable to the public that they serve. And because of that, we see that politics and policies irrevocably, sort of irresistibly, they gravitate towards the prerogatives of individuals, of these officials, of an elected and unelected class of bureaucrats that degrade the quality of government that we as individuals enjoy. So as I went through my time in the classified world, the intelligence community, as we call it,
And I moved from the Central Intelligence Agency to the National Security Agency. I worked on both the public sides and the private sides as a contractor working for private companies, but at a government desk in government facilities using government equipment and working on government programs and taking tasking from government employees, I gained an increasingly concerning understanding of what happens on the broad scale, what the results of all these individual decisions are. And that's generally that when decisions are made in the dark, the quality of those decisions is reduced. Now, that's not to say that we need to know every decision that the government makes, you know, who's under investigation, what this particular program does, but we do have to have a general understanding of the policies and the powers broadly that a government claims if it's going to be using them in our name, as well as being using them against us. And ultimately, toward the end of my tenure at the NSA, I discovered that there were programs of mass surveillance that were happening beyond any possible statutory authority because these things were constitutionally prohibited. These were things that never should have happened. They were initially authorized in the Bush administration, and that administration actually was fully aware in their own classified opinions in the Inspector General's report that those programs had no statutory basis. And so we saw developments where they were trying to authorize these under the president's powers. You know, they were using Article 2 powers, where basically the president says, we're at war, I can do basically whatever I want. Now, that may sound like a great idea and be an important power in times of total war, in times of existential threat. But we don't have U-boats in the harbor. We don't have, you know, foreign armies marching on American soil. We haven't seen total war policies in the United States since World War II. And so we have to ask, why were these decisions being made? Why was the public not allowed to participate in the debate? And why is it that even within the separate branches of government, officials were not aware of this? Within the executive branch, you know, in the intelligence community, many of my coworkers, who also had top secret clearances, high-level accesses, were unaware that these things were going on. The vast majority of Congress had no idea that these programs had been instituted or were being maintained. Even those on the intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House were not fully briefed. Only the gang of eight, that'd be the chairs, the ranking members, and then the majority and minority leaders for both houses, are briefed on so-called covert action programs and things like that, exceptionally compartmented programs. And the courts have increasingly, in the wake of the post-9/11 period, become reluctant to scrutinize decisions or programs that were constitutionally questionable, saying that they lacked the expertise or the positioning or what it ultimately boiled down to was the political willingness to confront difficult questions to which there may or may not be right answers once they're right and wrong. So this led me to stand up and say something about it. And I worked with American journalists and American news outlets to make sure that the public had an ability to make decisions about where the lines in this program should be drawn. Many people are familiar with the story since then. It's still ongoing. The reporting continues. But the ultimate basis is that many people consider the last year's surveillance of unconstitutional activity at the NSA and so on and so forth to be ultimately about surveillance and mass surveillance. And that is a critical issue, and it's the one with which I'm most familiar, and I saw the greatest wrongdoing. However, it's important to be aware that the reality that mass surveillance illustrates is that we have agencies that are working on their own authorities, they're working on their own sort of institutional momentum to implement programs without oversight, creating these things behind closed doors without the awareness of the public, that are actually changing the boundaries of the rights that we enjoy as free people in a free society. We have lost, in many ways, the freedom to associate without judgment in the United States because of the metadata program. That's really an associational tracking program. When we have everyone's call records, we know who everyone's friends are. We know who they contact. We know what they do. We know when they travel. We know where they go. We know how long they're there. There are speech implications to this. There are obviously privacy implications to this, and there is a very strong argument to be made that even if we as a society believed that these powers and authorities would be valuable, that we could not institute them through statute regardless, that they simply would be unconstitutional in any form
absent an amendment. And we see this happening and being upheld even through international laws decisions very recently. Two or three days ago, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Countering Terrorism and Protecting Human Rights delivered a report that had been in the works for, I believe, several years that found that mass surveillance programs violate the obligations of states that the United States and the United Kingdom and other many of our other allies have agreed to under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, as well as, and this wasn't mentioned specifically, but the very same right that he was highlighting in this report was an obligation we had agreed to under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, some 50-odd years back. And that's Article 12, and that's that we all have a right to privacy, to be free from unjustified, unreasonable intrusions into our lives. And we have this, of course, under our own Fourth Amendment. So when it came to my story and how I came forward, it was not that I saw a particular program and I had an axe to grind. It was that broadly I was witness to massive violations of our Constitution, that they were happening in secret, and that they were happening as a result of a broad breakdown throughout the branches of government. And this is the key. Because when there's a problem in a single agency, when there's a problem in a single branch, we tend to be self-correcting. That's what checks and balances are for. But the question of whistleblowing, of when to stand up, is really one of, do those checks and balances still function? Can you report these issues within a system, to a certain branch, to a certain organization, to a certain office, and actually see those abuses and those policies corrected? And in this case, they were not. We saw both the courts, Congress, and the executive had all failed in different portions of these programs and protecting our rights.
That's Edward Snowden there speaking a couple of weeks ago. Martin, this brings up all sorts of questions. I mean, he's talking there about the undoing, effectively, of the post-World War II settlement of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. He's also talking about mass surveillance being allowed again, a lack of privacy, destruction of privacy. And as I mentioned, he didn't, but I did, which is this book, IBM and the Holocaust, by Edwin Black. Now, Edwin Black in that book talks about the US cooperation with the Nazis in the 1930s, actually making money out of providing sort of profiling and databases of all their citizens for the regime to use as they, whatever, however they pleased.
Well, I mean, obviously, mass surveillance, which is illegal, I mean, it's in the US Constitution, they're not supposed to intervene with any private communications unless they have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed. It's in the Constitution. So he's quite right, it's all unconstitutional. But the real problem is not just the mass surveillance, it's that the people doing the mass surveillance, supposedly to protect us from terrorists, are the terrorists. They're not just surveying us, they're also planting the bombs.
There's also cooperation between the Nazis and the US after the war. I mean, there was with Brits, but to a bigger extent in the US, there was that headline back last year, people with a Nazi past collected $20 million in US retirement benefits. Even though many of them had gone abroad, they were still being paid by the US government. This is Nazi potential war criminals.
Well, look, as we've covered on this show many times, there's overwhelming evidence that the Nazi intelligence structure was taken over lock, stock and barrel by NATO when NATO was being set up. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to be the head of the Gestapo, ends up running the BND, the so-called Democratic Germany's intelligence service. And the methods that the Nazis pioneered in the 30s are now being carried out on a mass scale by the NATO powers and their Islamist allies.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, it was 100 years ago this week, the Battle of the Somme. It was raging. Contrary to what Michael Gove called a just war, it was one of the most pointless mass human sacrifices in history. The first ever use of tanks by the British Army was just about 100 years ago, and there were over 1 million British, German and French casualties. But Germany sued for peace in October 1916, and the Battle of the Somme ended in conclusion conclusively after that. So I thought we'd go back and have a listen back to 1961 to a talk which was given by a guy called Benjamin Friedman. He was a US businessman, and it was given at the Willard Hotel. One of the things he does, which is a little bit distasteful, is that he conflates Jews with Zionists, but he explains what the Zionist role was in the US coming into the war, which was basically halfway through World War I, after the battle.
1914 was the year in which World War I broke out. There are a few people here my age who remember that. Now, that war was waged on one side by Great Britain, France, and Russia, and on the other side by Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. What happened? Within 2 years, Germany had won that war. Not alone won it nominally, but won it actually. The German submarines, which were a surprise to the world, had swept all the convoys from the Atlantic Ocean, and Great Britain stood there without ammunition for her soldiers, stood there with 1 week's food supply facing her, and after that, starvation. At that time, the French army had mutinied. They lost 600,000 of the flower of the French youth in the defense of Verdun on the Somme. The Russian army was defecting. They were picking up their toys and going home. They didn't want to play war anymore. They didn't like the Tsar. And the Italian army had collapsed. Now, Germany, not a shot had been fired on the German soil. Not an enemy soldier had crossed the border into Germany. And yet, here was Germany offering England peace terms. They offered England a negotiated peace on what the lawyers call a status quo ante basis. That means, let's call the war off and let everything be as it was before the war started. Well, England in the summer of 1916 was considering that seriously. They had no choice. They was either accepting this negotiated peace that Germany was magnanimously offering them, or going on with the war and being totally defeated. While that was going on, the Zionists in Germany, who represented the Zionists from Eastern Europe, went to the British War Cabinet, and I'm going to be brief because this is a long story, but I have all the documents to prove any statement that I make. If anyone here is curious or doesn't believe what I'm saying is at all possible, the Zionists in London went to the British War Cabinet and they said, look here, you can yet win this war. You don't have to give up. You don't have to accept a negotiated peace offered to you now by Germany. You can win this war if the United States will come in as your ally. The United States was not in the war at that time. We were fresh. We were young. We were rich. We were powerful. And they told England, we will guarantee to bring the United States into the war as your ally, to fight with you on your side, if you will promise us Palestine after you win the war. In other words, they made this deal. We will get the United States into this war as your ally. The price you must pay us is Palestine after you have won the war and defeated Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. Now, England had as much right to promise Palestine to anybody as the United States would have to promise Japan to Ireland for any reason whatsoever. It's absolutely absurd that Great Britain, that never had any connection or any interest or any right in what is known as Palestine, should offer it as coin of the realm to pay the Zionists for bringing the United States into the war. However, they made that promise in October of 1916. October 1916. And shortly after that, I don't know how many here remember it. The United States, which was almost totally pro-German, because the newspapers here were controlled by Jews, the bankers were Jews, all the media of mass communications in this country were controlled by Jews, and they were pro-German because their people, in a majority of cases, came from Germany, and they wanted to see Germany lick the Tsar. The Jews didn't like the Tsar, and they didn't want Russia to win this war. So the German bankers, the German Jews, Kuhn Loew, and the other big banking firms in the United States, refused to finance France or England to the extent of $1. They stood aside and they said, as long as France and England are tied up with Russia, not 1 cent. But they poured money into Germany, they fought with Germany against Russia, trying to lick the Tsarist regime. Now, those same Jews, when they saw the possibility of getting Palestine, they went to England and they made this deal. At that time, everything changed, like the traffic light that changes from red to green, where the newspapers had been all pro-German, where they'd been telling the people the difficulties that Germany was having fighting Great Britain commercially and in other respects. All of a sudden, the Germans were no good. They were villains. They were Huns. They were shooting Red Cross nurses. They were cutting off babies' hands, and they were no good. Well, shortly after that, Mr. Wilson declared war on Germany. The Zionists in London sent these cables to the United States, to Justice Brandeis, go to work on President Wilson. We're getting from England what we want. Now you go to work, and you go to work on President Wilson and get the United States into the war. And that did happen. That's how the United States got into the war. We had no more interest in it. We had no more right to be in it than we have to be on the moon tonight instead of in this room. Now, the war, World War I, in which the United States participated, had absolutely no reason to be our war. We went in there, we were railroaded into it. If I can be vulgar, we were suckered into that war merely so that the Zionists of the world could obtain Palestine. Now, that is something that the people in the United States have never been told. They never knew why we went into World War I. Now, what happened? After we got into the war, the Zionists went to Great Britain and they said, well, we performed our part of the agreement. Let's have something in writing that shows that you are going to keep your bargain and give us Palestine after you win the war. Because they didn't know whether the war would last another year or another 10 years. So they started to work out a receipt. The receipt took the form of a letter, and it was worded in very cryptic language so that the world at large wouldn't know what it was all about. And that was called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was merely Great Britain's promise to pay the Zionists what they had agreed upon as a consideration for getting the United States into the war. So this great Balfour Declaration that you hear so much about is just as phony as a $3 bill, and I don't think I can make it more emphatic than that. Now, that is where all the trouble started. The United States was in the war. The United States crushed Germany. We went in there, and it's history. You know what happened. Now, when the war was ended and the Germans went to Paris, to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, there were 117 Jews there as a delegation representing the Jews headed by Bernard Baruch. I was there. I ought to know. Now, what happened? The Zionists at that peace conference, when they were cutting up Germany and parceling out Europe to all these nations that claimed a right to a certain part of European territory, the Jew says, how about Palestine for us? And they produced, for the first time, to the knowledge of Germans, this Balfour Declaration. So the Germans, for the first time, realized, oh, that was the game. That's why the United States came into the war. And the Germans, for the first time, realized that they were defeated. They suffered this terrific reparations that was slapped onto them because the Zionists wanted Palestine. And they were determined to get it at any cost. Now, that brings us up to another very interesting point. When the Germans realized this, they naturally resented it. Up to that time, the Jews had never been better off in any country in the world than they had been in Germany. You had Mr. Rathenau there, who was maybe 100 times as important in industry and finance as Bernard Baruch in this country. You had Mr. Balin, who owned the two big steamship lines, the North German Lloyd and the Hamburg American line. You had Mr. Bleichsröder, who was the banker for the Hohenzollern family. You had the Warburgs in Hamburg, who were the big merchant bankers, the biggest in the world. The Jews were doing very well in Germany. No question about that. Now, the Germans felt, well, that was quite a sellout. It was a sellout that I can best compare. Suppose the United States was at war today with the Soviet Union. And we were winning. And we told the Soviet Union, well, let's quit. We offer you peace terms. Let's forget the whole thing. And all of a sudden, Red China came into the war as an ally of the Soviet Union. And throwing them into the war brought about our defeat, a crushing defeat, with a reparations the likes of which man's imagination cannot encompass. Imagine, then, after that defeat, if we found out that it was the Chinese in this country, our Chinese citizens, who all the time we thought they were loyal citizens working with us, were selling us out to the Soviet Union, and it was through them that Red China was brought into the war against us. How would we feel in the United States against Chinese? I don't think one of them would dare show his face on any street. There wouldn't be lampposts enough convenient to take care of them. Imagine how we would feel. Well, that's how the Germans felt towards these Jews.
Well, it's an interesting story, Martin, 100 years on from the Battle of the Somme, a million casualties, where really the First World War should have ended. But how true is it?
Well, I listened to all of that. I mean, clearly the Zionists did have some influence because they got what they wanted in terms of the Balfour Declaration. And people like Lord Rothschild, who was very influential financially.
Yeah, he was Walter Rothschild, Rothschild.
Yeah, but I mean, they were pretty clear about what their demands were.
And who, it's just, well, because we're mentioning the Balfour Declaration, let's just be clear. There were two apparent Balfour Declarations, one in 1926. And funnily enough, I put into Google, shame on me, Balfour Declaration. Of course, it comes up 1926, but there is a previous one, as you've said, in 1917, which was from Arthur James Balfour, who was the British Foreign Secretary, a letter to Walter Rothschild from the banking family in November 1917, which was then published in the newspapers in
Indeed.
Britain.
I think what's interesting is at that stage of the war, before America had come in, Woodrow Wilson had stood in the 1916 general election in the US, and his slogan was peace without victory. At the same time, in February 1917, sometime shortly after, in February 1917, you had the February Revolution in Russia, with the Russian, with the, basically the Russians saying, we want peace, and the Social Democrats were pushing the regime in Germany, saying, look, the Russians want peace, the Americans want peace. The people who didn't want peace at that stage were the British and the French, because they felt they'd made so many sacrifices, because what the peace was would have been on offer is everybody just goes back to their start lines and we just forget about the whole thing. And that wasn't acceptable to, you know, forces at work in Britain and in France. But in America, that was quite a popular position. It's quite strange that Wilson then completely reversed it.
What about the sinking of the Lusitania? Because that was the excuse that was used. Well, a little bit like Pearl Harbor, wasn't it?
The Lusitania,
yeah. What was the Lusitania?
Well, because the Lusitania, unrestricted submarine warfare by the Germans, was frankly an own goal. If they'd kept to just sinking British ships, that would have been a very good strategy. But, of course, if they're going to sink any ship, then you get to a situation where the Americans are kind of, you know, basically provoked into the war. But, of course, the Lusitania was, in fact, carrying weaponry. It was a passenger ship, but it was taking weaponry to Britain. So you could argue that it was a legitimate target. But, of course, it was a pretty much an own goal from the German general staff point of view.
Anyway, this kind of problem between whether the Zionists are real Jews or not has gone on and on and on ever since then, really, since November 1917 in the Balfour Declaration, and just very recently, just in May this year, Vice News did a very good report, I thought, anyway, on these anti-Zionist Jews, Naturi Carter, who are from Stanford Hill. And here's Melina Larson from Vice News talking to Rabbi Black about why it is that the Orthodox Jews, at least some of them, just don't think that Israel is actually a Jewish nation.
I'm trying to find where Rabbi Back lives. He's invited us over because some of the guys from the Naturi Carter are coming over to make banners for protests happening for Nakba Day.
Nakba means the disaster in Arabic. Nakba Day is the day Palestinians mourn their displacement when the State of Israel was created. But this is also Israeli Independence Day, when Israelis have a party to celebrate the creation of their country.
Hello, how are you?
Tomorrow going to be a demonstration against the State of Israel. We participate in these demonstrations to bring out our message to show for the world that Jews and Zionists are not the same thing.
Also, you look at all the signs here. Every sign of them is zusammengestellt von vier. There's a push to that.
Judaism rejects the State of Israel and condemns its atrocities.
Yes.
The protest falls on a Saturday, the Sabbath. So there's a bunch of restrictions they must stick to, one being not to use public transport.
This is a Hyde Park, where the Israeli embassy is located, just here.
Okay.
Our synagogue is located here.
This is going to be such a long walk.
It's a long of 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours?
Yes.
So we need to be prepared.
Shabbos, we are not allowed to touch any electric device. We can't speak into the mic. And also, when we're walking, we need a non-Jewish man going between us.
Okay, so everything will be okay as long as there's a man standing between you and me.
Yes.
And you cannot talk straight into the microphone.
And also, Saturday, we are not carrying nothing. Nothing, nothing. We're not carrying nothing. This is one of the laws.
So you're going to walk across the entirety of London for 3 hours carrying signs?
No. You forgot we are not allowed to carry Saturday anything. We will wear it on.
Okay.
It's not easy to be Jewish. Don't become Jewish.
There are going to be a lot of Palestinians present at the protest. How will you be received?
Oh, very, very welcomed. Very welcomed. When we coming many times.
Do pro-Israeli people come down? And
yes, 100%. They feel very angry and they're crying on us. But what can we say? We bring out the right message of Judaism, and this is the right message of Judaism. I mean, when you look, who is the real Jew? Look at me, and look at him. He don't look as a Jew at all. He don't keep the Shabbos. He have no problem with Shabbos like I have. He don't walk to the protest 3 hours. He just coming by the car and park it inside. And you say, oh, I'm a religion Jew.
So are there like clashes when the pro-Israelis come down and they see you wearing Free Palestine?
Yes, because of that we have the police.
So does it get violent?
Usually not. The police watch. If not the police, then it gets violent, of course. We hope to bring out our message for the world to know. You know, the Zionists have the power and the media have the power. And we haven't got nothing. We have only one thing. We have got on our side.
That's a report from Vice News there, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page, really showing that there are Orthodox Jews in London that don't agree that the Israeli state is in any way Jewish. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Kamal. Our sister show, Dialect, airs BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This week, it's with this former Eton guy, David Guinness. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Martin Foda. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please join us for the Politics Show the same time next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome. I am Malihe Razazan, and with me here is Khalil Bendib. Hi, Khalil.
Hi, Malihe. This week, we'll bring you an exclusive interview with award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich on his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. Ehrenreich spent 3 years traveling and reporting from the occupied West Bank. In this book, he details the complexities of everyday life under occupation and the specific mechanisms of what he calls the giant humiliation machine that control Palestinian lives.
And as you may know, we are in the midst of our fall membership drive, and this is a very special membership drive, and we hope you can join other listeners and support us by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. If you appreciate this kind of programming that brings you analysis as well as celebrations of arts and cultures of the Middle East and North Africa, please do give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, or donate securely online at kpfa.org. Now, here is Ben reading an excerpt from his book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine.
Telling the stories that I am telling, choosing certain stories and not others, means taking a side. This is unavoidable and only a sin to those standing on the other side. No spectators at chasm's door, wrote the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. And no one is neutral here. Not anywhere, but especially not in Palestine. I do not aspire in these pages to objectivity. I don't believe it to be a virtue or even a possibility. We are all of us subjects, stuck fast to bodies, places, histories, points of view. Insistence on objectivity is always, Frantz Fanon observed more than half a century ago, directed against someone. For Fanon, that someone was the colonized, the marginalized, and the oppressed. The truth of this soon becomes clear to any journalist or any morally sensitive individual who chooses to work and live in the West Bank. Simply to refer to it by that name, rather than as Judea and Samaria, to call it Palestine rather than Eretz Israel, is to already be involved. And to base oneself there, rather than in Tel Aviv or West Jerusalem or Washington or New York, is to enter the conflict, whether one wishes to or not. If the nature of this choice is at first not obvious, the soldiers at the checkpoints can be counted on to quickly make it so.
That is part of the introduction to your book. And you clearly say that you're not after offering a so-called objective representation of the place and its people. So you're a longtime journalist. You've reported from war zones in Afghanistan and Haiti, I believe. When it came to going and reporting and writing about Palestine, is that when you decided that you really need to leave this so-called journalistic objectivity aside and you really have to approach this place in a different way? Or this is something that you have believed all along as a journalist?
It's something I've believed all along. And to my relief, I had a conversation with Ed Wasserman, who's the head of the UC Berkeley Journalism School, a week and a half ago, and he said that they don't teach objectivity anymore, which is a relief, because I think objectivity as a journalistic virtue has always been used to disguise one's actual politics. You know, we see it very frequently in the mainstream news outlets, where through the veil of objectivity, they're able to hide, you know, really clear and powerful biases towards power.
You traveled to many, many places in the West Bank, and you spent more time in certain areas and cities and villages than others. Throughout your travels, you heard stories from Palestinians, but you sometimes said, I have seen this being retold or repeated by many other people, but I personally cannot verify that. Why did you have to say that?
I say later on in that same introduction, I don't believe in objectivity. I do believe in truth. I do believe that journalists have an obligation to be as absolutely rigorous as they can be. And, you know, there are things that everyone says again and again that can't be verified. And sometimes they're true and sometimes they're not. And rather than some sort of false objectivity, what I can do is be as transparent as possible and tell you what I know and what I don't know and what I can verify and what I can't. That's where the journalist's obligations lie.
In this book, you were after finding out the truth. You did some research, of course, before going to Palestine, but what did you know about Israeli occupation and Zionism before you set foot in Ramallah?
Before the first time that I went in 2011, I certainly knew more than, considerably more than your average well-informed American reader. Mm-hmm. I'd read as much as I could about the conflict and the occupation, but I was nonetheless really powerfully moved and disturbed when I got there by how bad things were, by how immediate and intimate the transformation of the landscape was, really the brutalization of the landscape by the occupation, the presence of checkpoints, of walls, of settlements on every hilltop, of surveillance infrastructure everywhere. And I think I was also really astounded by the pace of things in a way that nothing I'd read prepared me for. That things were always happening. And, you know, when you live there, it no longer feels fast, it just feels constant. In that brief period, that first time that I was there, land confiscations, home demolitions, arrests, you know, pretty much everywhere I went, something seemed to be happening. Either I spent time briefly in the Jordan Valley and a family was being dislodged from their home by settlers in the settlement across the hill who had decided to camp just outside their property to intimidate them and chase them away, settlers with automatic weapons. In Nabi Saleh, the village outside Ramallah where I would later spend a great deal of time, in the period that I was there, Bassem Tamimi, who I would later come to know quite well, when I met him, he was in hiding. By the time I left, he'd been arrested.
You actually met him in Ramallah while there were protests going on. It was during the 2011 Arab uprisings.
Yeah, I mean, it really just by chance, the first day that I set foot in the city of Ramallah was March 15th of 2011. And that day would later become memorialized in the name of the small activist movement called the March 15th Movement, which chose that day to stage protests around the West Bank and also in Gaza. And it had been 2 months since the beginning of the Egyptian Revolution. Everything all over the Middle East was very rapidly changing. And it was a moment of great hope in Palestine, too. I think there was some hope that it would break the paralysis that had for so long kept people stuck. And that movement was their cause, as they articulated it, was to end the division between Fatah and Hamas and to create a unified front against the occupation, both in Gaza, where Hamas is in power, and in the West Bank, where Fatah is in power. The movement ended up being repressed by the powers that be, who I think correctly understood it as a threat to their own authority.
Yeah, Palestinian authority, yeah. You mean? Yeah. They beat up some of the protesters. They arrested them. So you went to the West Bank in 2011, and you were on a project for Harper's Magazine. You were going to write a piece about water issues in the West Bank. And then you went back again in 2012, and this time you were going to report for the New York Times magazine. And in 2013, the New York Times magazine published your article, which was called If There Is a Third Intifada, We Want to Be the Ones Who Started It. And this is about the village, Nabi Saleh. That long feature piece got a lot of traction and a lot of responses in the U.S. How did you decide from writing just articles about Palestine to writing a book about Palestine?
Well, I did want to tell their stories. I didn't want to play the role of the white guy representing Palestinian voices. Mm-hmm. I had two purposes. One was to describe these realities and tell these stories to an audience that for the most part is not exposed to them. Because it was really clear to me, and the more time I spent there, how tiny an aperture America is allowed to view the situation there through. And it's mainly through Israeli perspectives. Mm-hmm. And the day-to-day realities of Palestinian life are, for the most part, completely invisible from the U.S. When Americans get to see Palestinians, it's as terrorists or as corpses, for the most part. And the absolutely insanely complex structures of the occupation and how it functions, if they're understood here at all, are understood simply as a machine for the security of Israelis, which is not, in fact, I believe, its purpose. So I did want to correct that imbalance and give an American audience an opportunity to really see this, and thought that I was in a unique position to be able to do so.
Do you think in the past few years there has been a shift in the way the Palestinian story and the occupation has been covered in the American press?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly when I got that assignment from the New York Times magazine, I was shocked that they were willing to, as I pitched the story to them, it was, I want to go spend time in this Palestinian village and write about things not within the frame of an Israeli security analysis, but just write about this resistance struggle on its own terms. I was completely shocked they went for it. I think a couple of years earlier that wouldn't have happened. Mm. You know, even the fact that this book is being published by a big press, I think
that's what I was surprised. Actually, I was looking at your previous novels, and they were by small publishing houses, and this one is published by Penguin.
Yeah, and I think a big press like Penguin wouldn't have taken a risk on this book if they didn't think that there was an audience for it. And I think there's been a slow process over the last 8 or 9 years by which what it's possible to say in the U.S. press has gotten broader. There was no issue in which censorship in the U.S. press, it's not a word we like to say in America. Mm. We don't have censorship. We have freedom of the press. But we do. And there was no issue where it was clearer than the issue of Palestine. It was absolutely clear that there were certain things you could not say in mainstream outlets. That, I think, has really changed. You know, an excerpt from this book was published in Politico.
Exactly. I have to say, I mean, it had a very provocative title, your article, yeah. How Israel Incites Palestinian Violence.
Yeah. I didn't choose the title. The editors chose the title. And I think they chose it because it would be provocative and controversial and it would get a lot of attention to the article. But the fact that they were willing to do that, that they weren't trying to hide.
So how do you think this happened?
I think it's happened on a few different levels. The main thing is, I think, the violence of the occupation and the violence of the siege in Gaza have become so extreme and so pervasive in the last decade. Really, every 2 years, there is a new assault on Gaza. Every time it happens, the casualty rate goes up. It was 1,400 in 2008, 2009. This last time, 2,200. It's always about a quarter children. It's always more than half civilians. And I think it does help that the Second Intifada is fading in American public memory. So Americans are not seeing Palestinians as suicide bombers, but they're seeing Palestinians as people who are being severely oppressed and repressed by the Israeli government. And I think a generation is getting older and dying out here that has a really deep sentimental attachment to Israel and identification with the Israeli state. I think younger Americans and even younger American Jews don't have this automatic identification with Israel that previous generations did have, and are able to see the dynamics of oppression and occupation that sustain Israel for what they are. That's changing the dynamic overall. its immediate consequences may be small, but I think it's still symbolically really important that Bernie Sanders was able to talk about Palestinian dignity in the Democratic debates with Hillary Clinton. To use the word Palestinian for a major Democratic candidate was way.
And the fact that the occupation and boycott divestment sanctioned is being argued and debated in the process of writing the Democratic Party platform.
Yeah, you know, Cornel West and James Zogby have promised to make a real issue of this. And I think we all know that the Democratic Party platform, if Hillary Clinton is the candidate, will be, even if they succeed and get some of this language into the platform, it will probably be discarded as soon as she takes office. Nonetheless, the fact that the stranglehold on discourse is being broken open, I think, is hugely significant. You know, I think we have to remember that Sanders is also a politician. And until a few months ago, Sanders was also refusing to criticize Israel publicly. He was defending Israel's actions in Gaza in the summer of 2014. But I think enough pressure was put on him by his own base, and he saw the polls. He saw the poll numbers, the Pew poll, which showed that more liberal people who identify as liberal Democrats identify with Palestinians than with Israelis. And I think he was reacting to this real and powerful demographic shift in this country.
And the fact that the boycott divestment and sanction movement in the U.S. and really across the world has made some tangible gains. And some of the activists in Palestine you spoke with, including Bassem, they believed that they have to change their tactics on the ground in Palestine as well. Bassem told you the Second Intifada had been catastrophic. Thousands had been killed and nothing gained but the wall and the checkpoint regime, more land loss, more settlements, more prisoners, the complete isolation of Gaza from the West Bank. The leadership had been decimated, the economy wrecked, the people exhausted politically. And he said, we went backwards. And the solidarity that had been characterized the First Intifada was long gone. Bassem was a youth organizer during the First Intifada, giving way in late 2006 to open combat between Fatah and Hamas. Bassem had no illusions that Nabi Saleh, his village, could topple the occupation on its own just by having weekly protests. But he said that it could provide the model, he hoped, some path forward out of the morass in which the West Bank was sunk. And other activists were thinking about the same models of resisting and fighting the occupation.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true of the popular resistance movement, of which the people of Nabi Saleh are certainly a part, and the activists who I ended up writing a lot about in Hebron as well, who work out of a center called Youth Against Settlements in Tel Rumeida. And, you know, certainly Bassem Tamimi was always really clear to me, he didn't disown military resistance, and he didn't condemn it. And I've been attacked, and certainly he's been attacked in most of those the same moments since the book came out for writing about these people who refuse to condemn terrorism. And he was always clear that, you know, there's an occupation and Palestinians have the right to resist, like any people under occupation, through military resistance or any other means. But he felt, and he certainly wasn't alone in feeling, that the tactics used in the Second Intifada were failures, and that trying to defeat a superior military power, because Israel is you know, one of the most powerful militaries in the world, on its own terms, through military resistance, was a guaranteed losing battle, and that some other method had to be found.
And he did not call it nonviolent. He called it unarmed struggle.
Yeah, he didn't. Others, like the guys in Hebron, do use the word nonviolent. But yeah, Bassem always said unarmed resistance. And I think that's because he wanted to avoid the entire question of violence. And I do understand why, that there is a discourse that's very strong in this country in which Palestinians are required, before they can be listened to, before they can be taken seriously, if their voices are going to be at all legitimate, they're required to disown violence. And no such requirement is ever made of Israelis. Certainly no such requirement is made of the United States. But somehow Palestinians are the one player in this who have to, before they can say a word, have to condemn their own right to armed resistance.
And he spoke about the first Intifada again, where there was this mass movement against the occupation. People were boycotting goods from Israel. People were organizing local committees. This is something that I think Bassem also saw as a continuation of the first Intifada. And also the use of internationals in the struggle. How important do you think that has been in Nabi Saleh? There are Israeli activists and international activists who joined them in their Friday protest against settlers. How important do you think international activism and international activists have been in globalizing the Palestinian struggle against the occupation?
I think, going back a little, I think it's hard to appreciate from 30 years later and from across the ocean how revolutionary a situation the First Intifada was. You know, at the time, the PLO was in exile in Tunisia. There wasn't a centralized leadership, at least at first, within Palestine. And you had this rebellion that really came from the grassroots, that came as the result of years of really quiet horizontal organizing, village by village, creating these village committees to allow villages autonomy. And certainly, I think, people of Bassem's generation who grew up in that situation of really extraordinary solidarity, I think he and others of his generation really feel like their revolution was taken away from them. Mm. Like they were part of a revolutionary struggle. And at some point, I think it's pretty clear, the point was around 1993, 1994, the Oslo years, that everything they had fought for was taken from them.
You describe Oslo as a counter-revolution.
Yeah, I think it very clearly was. Oslo, for people who don't know, created the Palestinian Authority. It created this sort of semblance of authority that was, in fact, still in every meaningful way answerable to Israel. And none of the brutalities of the occupation were lifted, but this extra power structure, this Palestinian power structure, was dropped into place. Inside, Israel was still pulling all the strings. And I think one of the failures that Bassem saw of the, and not just Bassem, but that generation of activists saw of the second Intifada was, you know, the first Intifada also had done a great deal to resurrect the Palestinian liberation movement for an international audience. Again, throughout the 70s, if people in the West who weren't already radicals had a notion of what Palestinians were and did, they thought of Leon Klinghoffer being thrown off the side of the Achille Lauro. They thought of cruel acts of terrorism. And the First Intifada presented, drilled into the minds of people around the world, these images of children, of school children, standing up to Israeli tanks with nothing but a stone in their hands. And that was extremely powerful. And I think people of Bassem's generation saw that had been lost. And one of the things that they tried to do in starting this unarmed resistance movement, which didn't start in Nabi Saleh, it started in some of the villages along the wall, was to open themselves both to an international solidarity movement and to Israelis who were willing to put down the privileges of Zionism and join them in a common fight against
them. Because the international activists, their presence would have probably gotten more attention from the international media?
I think they knew from the start that they couldn't do this alone, mm-hmm. that the power of this kind of resistance was in many ways dependent on the media, that if the media wasn't present and you had a group of Palestinians marching without weapons or perhaps throwing stones, that they could easily be just very brutally repressed by the Israeli army. The repression, even with cameras there and even with foreign journalists there, is still quite brutal. But the IDF would hesitate if there were, in fact, cameras there, and that they could create a kind of symbolic resistance for the international media, which is what they ended up doing. There is a core of a sort of rotating core, people don't usually stay more than a few years, of really good, courageous, committed foreign journalists who live in Ramallah and around the West Bank. But for the most part, most foreign journalists who come in for a few days or a couple of weeks when there's a real outbreak of violence.
Yeah, and those journalists who stay, and some of them are, many of them actually are freelancers.
Yeah.
We don't get to hear from them very much unless you really look for the reporting. Otherwise, it's not something that you get to see in sort of a mainstream commercial corporate media all the time.
The corporate media correspondents live in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv,
exactly.
which does profoundly affect the way they report on the situation.
Welcome back. I am Malihera Zazan, and you are listening to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and I'm here with my colleague Khalil Bendib, and we're going to take a short break and ask you to support this program and other programs on KPFA. This is our membership, our fall membership drive. We will end on Friday at 7 p.m., so you have really two and a half days to support this precious station, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and also support the work of courageous and brave journalists like Ben, who spent 3 years in Palestine to bring us profound and amazing, incredible stories weaved in with the history and politics of Palestine. It is one of those books that you have not really read like it before. So this is an exceptional book, and we are giving away the book for a pledge of $110, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine by Ben Ehrenreich. 1-800-439-5732, or you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Khalil?
Yes, a remarkable, courageous man, this guy Ben Ehrenreich. I wasn't aware of his work until this book came out.
Yes.
I'm really impressed by the depth of his knowledge. He really brings a very good view and analysis to the recent history of Palestinian resistance.
And I think something that makes this book really in some ways different, because he's an amazing novelist. He's an award-winning novelist. And this book is both a work of, it's written like a book of fiction, but it's a non-fiction book. So it's 450 pages. It has over 120 pages in footnotes, but it reads really like a novel. So it's, and it is divided up into four different parts, and he looks at various aspects of this complex web of occupation in how it really controls the Palestinian lives, or I should say it tries to control the Palestinian lives. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Khalil, we just got a very, very generous guest, a pledge from a listener who doesn't want to be thanked on the air. Thank you so much for that pledge. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. You and I, before coming on the air, we were talking about all the activities around BDS, Palestine, that has been happening just in California itself in the past few weeks. We have had victories, and we are waiting for some other news, which is the bill that is on Jerry Brown's desk to be signed. These
AB 2844.
Yes, yeah. AB 2844, that he could sign or veto it. And I think people should call in for people who are concerned about that.
There's a campaign Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yes, so this is really important. And also what happened at UC Berkeley. Really, the power of organizing across a wide spectrum. I mean, it was different scholarly associations, professors, students, administrators.
Amazing.
It was really amazing.
You know, we've seen it happen over the past decade, gradually, incrementally, but still it's amazing that it's happening. We're used to these undemocratic happenings, you know, people just out of the
blue. Tell us what happened at UC Berkeley, Khalil.
Well, basically, there's a class that's being taught as we speak there's a whole bunch of classes taught by students that are part of the curriculum. You can't use them as part of your credits
It's a one-unit class,
diploma,
and it's called DECAL. Yeah.
But it's important because these classes are there, and they're reaching a lot of people. Very informative. One of them is about Palestine from a the lens of settler colonialism.
Yeah.
It's the title. It's a look at Palestinian history through the lens of settler colonialism, which of course is not meant to please.
That's true.
The pro-Israel people who are
and
trying
the chancellor
to,
basically suspended it and
right.
The
so the chancellor,
yeah.
as we're used to seeing, tried to cancel that class. But there was so much backlash that
they reinstated it.
Yeah, they reinstated it. We're not used to these second shoes dropping, where, well, you know, the will of the majority, the democracy seems to be prevailing.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. The Way to the Spring: Life and Death in Palestine by Ben Ehrenreich, and he is the son of the great. A journalist, writer, Barbara Ehrenreich,
yeah.
Who is a friend of KPFA and Pacifica. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. I cannot say enough about this book. Again, this book is about 450 pages, is a gem of a book. And something that is so amazing about Ben, which I always appreciate, is the respect that he has for the Palestinians and the fact that he allows them to tell their own stories instead of him coming in and trying to paraphrase it or trying to basically take over their narrative. And also, the other thing is that he stayed there for 3 years. He spent 3 years not only observing, but also participating, staying with them, and learning the ways of everyday life in Palestine. And he really brings a beautifully weaved picture of history, the narratives about the daily lives of Palestinians, what they are facing today and how they are resisting. And some of the conversations are extremely candid. It's not just about occupation. It's also about the internal dynamics and tension and dichotomies within the Palestinian movement, within the West Bank. So this is an amazing book, and I hope you call 1-800-439-5732 and get a copy of this book or kpfa.org. I want to thank Al Alusi for his generous contribution. Thank you so much. We got another contribution.
Generous, yeah.
Really, we are getting amazing, amazing, amazing and generous contributions today. And this is really a vindication of our work. This is something that we really have to... thank you for the help and support that you're giving. And I just want all to say that Ben, because of his book, he has come under immense amount of attack. I mean, he's been attacked, he's been threatened, and you can read about his experiences since his book came out on his blog, Ben Ehrenreich. He's truly a courageous journalist, and he's not getting interviews very much.
Well, in the mainstream, you can
he's
expect
not.
That.
So this is a home of young, amazing, brave reporters and storytellers like Ben. And I hope by supporting us, you are telling people like Ben, go ahead and do these stories, because we will allow you to speak without any filters and censorship. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Khalil, you wanted to say
it's
something?
It's just such a hopeful thing to see. I mean, to behold that we have spawned a new generation that's a lot smarter than we are. When I say we're in our 50s and some, you know, now we're seeing these people in their 20s and 30s, and they're coming up with all these incredible new movements, these really smart tactics.
And you know, Ben is Jewish. But he writes on his blog, he says, I don't see any point in remaining quiet about this. In the last week alone, and this happened in August, I have repeatedly been called a Jew hater, a terrorist, a murderer of children and pregnant women.
It has been suggested to me that I should and may suffer a terrorist attack. I have been wished a painful death and promised that I will get, quote, what is coming to me. I am not complaining. I knew what I was getting into.
Well, he's not the only one. A lot of young Jews now, younger Jews, are incredibly courageous, and they stand up for their values regardless of the pressure from the elders, from the mainstream. And it's happening. It's just fantastic.
We want to support the works of these journalists, and we want you to support their work. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We're going to listen to another excerpt of the interview, my interview with Ben, and then we will be back. Thank you. I'm speaking with Ben Ehrenreich. He is an award-winning journalist and author of two novels, Ether and The Suitors. His latest book, The Way to Spring, is based on his 3 years of reporting from the West Bank, and he joins me in studio. In your book, you focus on three places: the village of Nabi Saleh, which has a population of about 500 people. The families in this village have been protesting weekly since 2009 for the right to use their spring water, which has been taken away by the settlers. And the city of Hebron that you write, if all of Palestine is marked by Pharaoh's and false realities that overlap but almost never intermingle, Hebron is a cartographic collapse. It is the only city in the West Bank that settlers have permanent presence. And also you talk about a quiet Bedouin community that has been gradually destroyed by occupation and by settlers.
Nabi Saleh was the place that really drew me into writing about the occupation generally. And I think the thing there that really grabbed me was in 2009 in Nabi Saleh, they started these demonstrations. Every Friday they would try to march down to the spring, and every Friday the army would meet them and greet them with various munitions, usually tear gas, rubber-coated steel bullets, sometimes live fire, other things. And the army would come back during the week, and they would do house raids, and they would arrest people, and they'd trash people's houses, and they would generally make people's lives very difficult. They would sometimes close off the gate to the village so people couldn't come or go, and make their lives extremely unpredictable, bring a lot of violence to their lives. And what really amazed me there was that these people kept doing it week after week. And all they had to do in order to just suffer the kind of baseline humiliation and uncertainties of the occupation was stop. On Fridays, stop. Stay in their houses. Visit their neighbors. Do what people do on Fridays in the Middle East. And they didn't. They kept going. And the costs only piled up. More people went to prison. Two young men were killed, Mustafa Tamimi and Rushdie Tamimi. One shot in the face with a tear gas canister, the other one shot in the back with a bullet from an M16. The loss of two young men in a village that small is really hard to overstate. And through all of these losses and through all of this grief, they kept going. And there, I think what fascinated me, not just for its window onto how the occupation functioned, but as a kind of urgent human question of how to resist against an enemy that is much stronger than you, how to resist in a situation where it seems like you can't win. I mean, these are problems that certainly anyone involved in political struggles in the U.S. or in most parts of the world has to
deal with. Though at some point, I think it was Bassem that told you, he said, it is not like we're going to get that land back or we're going to get that spring back, but we need to do these weekly protests because we want to tell them that we exist and we're here.
And the costs were huge. And one of the greatest costs was children take part in the protest there, and children would be beaten, children would be arrested, children would see their parents arrested, children would suffer all of these kinds of violence. And it's something that both sympathetic visitors to the village always come home puzzled by. It's something that critics of the resistance there always latch onto, is that they involve their children in this, which is, I know from getting to know these people well, was an incredibly difficult and painful decision for them to do. Yeah, and when they talked about it, when Nariman, Bassem's wife, who was also a leader in the movement, talked about it, she said, you know, should I teach my children to be weak? Should I teach them to cower? Should I teach them to be afraid? And this sense that there are no good choices here at all. There is ultimately the possibility of sort of surrender or resistance. This is how they saw it. And to resist means making all of these awful sacrifices, but to surrender means making a different set of sacrifices that were even more difficult and untenable for them.
So what has happened to the village of Nabi Saleh? The weekly protests continue.
It's now Ramadan, and this year during Ramadan, they decided not to hold them. Over the years, especially these last 2 years, the numbers have really dropped. The consequences inside the village have been pretty profound. I think they're a growing part of the village wanted to stop them altogether, didn't think it was worth it. There were other sort of internal conflicts, which I think is inevitable in any movement like this. It's now been almost 7 years that they've been doing this, and they've, I think, accomplished a great deal in terms of getting the word out.
Also, there was a pressure from the Palestinian Authority for them to limit their protests or areas that they protested?
There was in the very beginning. I don't think they felt that later on, but in the very beginning they were told by the PA that as long as they kept their protests outside of the parts of the village which officially the PA was supposed to be responsible for security in, it was fine. So in other words, the PA didn't care so long as they weren't involved. As long as they were just dealing with the Israelis directly, the PA was fine. But the PA told them to keep it out of the parts of the village in which they would actually be called in to do something. And in this case, since then, I think the PA has become much more open in repressing Palestinian resistance, not in Nabi Saleh, but in many other parts of the West Bank, very commonly in Ramallah, commonly in Hebron, commonly in the major cities. The PA actively represses, and by actively I mean with many of the same weapons that the Israelis use, but often just with clubs beating down protesters who are attempting to directly protest. I think it's Raja Shahad that writes about the Allenby Bridge crossing, the main crossing the Palestinians are allowed to use between Jordan and the West Bank. There's this mirrored glass, and when Palestinians cross, they hand their passports or their documents to a Palestinian official. But behind the mirrored glass, there are Israeli officials who are looking on and making the decisions about who can come and who can go and who won't be allowed to pass. That mirrored glass is a good metaphor for how the occupation has functioned since Oslo generally, that there is this facade of the Palestinian Authority, but behind it, in every way that counts, there are Israelis making the decisions.
And also you write about how, because the Palestinian Authority employs majority of the Palestinians in the West Bank, and also a lot of them have been absorbed, and they are part of the security infrastructure in the West Bank, they are using also bureaucratic means of preventing or intimidating Palestinians from joining the protests.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great difficulties that the popular resistance faced, and I think that any kind of resistance faces in Palestine right now, that the PA employs a huge percentage of the Palestinian population. When we talk about the PA security forces repressing Palestinian protests, it's not quite so simple, since a lot of the Palestinian security forces, it's a huge employer, and a lot of the security forces are people who used to be involved in the resistance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, it's extremely galling to them that they're being called on to defend the occupation. Palestinian society is really quite trapped in this way, and it's a trap that so far no one's figured out how to get out of.
I am Maliheh Razazan, and I'm speaking with award-winning journalist and novelist Ben Ehrenreich about his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. In the book, he vividly documents the specific mechanisms of what he calls the giant humiliation machine that's controlling Palestinians' lives under occupation. One of the most powerful parts of your book is your observations and writing about Hebron. You call it Planet Hebron.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote in the book that in the end it wasn't reading about the structures of the occupation or reading about colonialism that helped me to understand Hebron the best. It was like works of science fiction, because Hebron often feels like you've stepped into the Twilight Zone. As you mentioned, it's the one city in the West Bank with a permanent presence of Israeli settlers in it, which means it's also a powerful presence of the Israeli military, which means there are checkpoints everywhere. The city is sort of infinitely sectioned off with intricate rules about who can be where when. The city was formally divided into H1 and H2, into sections under the control of the Palestinian Authority and under the control, direct control of the Israeli military. Within the section that's under the control of the Israeli military, there are places where Palestinians where they can walk but not drive. There's places where they can drive and walk. There are places where they can't even walk. The latter, where no Palestinians can be, those are called sterile zones by the IDF. Sterility, meaning free of the germs, the possible infection of a Palestinian presence. And there are endless checkpoints and endless intimate, bizarre, and hostile contacts between Palestinians and settlers. The settlers live right among the Palestinian population, are a distinctly hostile presence, and often a violent presence. The level of uncertainty and fear is extremely high, really at any moment. The tiniest thing can set off a conflict.
And the settlers are free to come and go.
Within the part of Hebron under Israeli control, absolutely. All of the rules which severely restrict the movements of Palestinians do not affect them. You see settlers jogging down the roads which are otherwise completely ghostly because all Palestinians have been
forced off. And they're gradually taking over the Palestinian homes, and and with the help of the Israeli military and Israeli occupation forces, they're taking over people's homes.
Yeah, it's really been there. It's really house by house. Mm-hmm. There'll be houses which have been, some of which have been abandoned by their Palestinian owners. A lot of Palestinians have been forced out, but a lot have just left because it's impossible to make a living or to survive in those situations. So most people who have other options and can afford to leave have left. You know, so settlers will begin squatting one of those buildings and claiming that they have some legal title to it. And then there's sometimes some sort of pro forma conflict with the Israeli government where the Israeli government will say, no, you can't stay there, and it'll go through the courts, and then eventually they get the house anyway.
You're right. People in Hebron used the word normal a lot. And you list a few of the things that people there told you were normal. Screaming. If you hear someone screaming because soldiers are beating him or settlers are beating him, it's normal. Being shot at and having rocks and Molotov cocktails thrown at your house. Or soldiers firing tear gas at school children to mark the beginning and the end of each day of classes, or being arrested, questioned for hours, and released without charges or apology. That's a normal thing, the Palestinian residents of Hebron told you.
Yeah, I mean, things that anywhere else would seem completely outlandish and bizarre and traumatic, Palestinians in Hebron shrug their shoulders and say, which means normal. So much of, you know, I'll give you one example. There's a house in the neighborhood of Tel Rumeida, which is one of the areas that settlers have taken over, a house called the Cage House, which is surrounded on three sides by settlers and an IDF base, and which has been completely cloaked with wire mesh over all the windows and doors because the settlers throw rocks and other things at them. And this family who lives in this house, it's the Abu Aisha house, is only the members of the family who live in the house are allowed to come and go. They have to pass through a checkpoint to get to their house. They can't be visited by anyone, by any other Palestinians who are not on the list. And you know, in Palestinian society, which is very deeply embedded in family connections, it's this kind of social death to be isolated from your family. And it means they're stuck in this house and they can't leave. So I spent a lot of time there. And one of the boys who lives in the house had a bicycle. And he would ride the bicycle around inside the house because it wasn't safe for him to ride it outside because the settlers' kids would beat him up. And, you know, that's one of the things that people shrug their shoulders and say, it's normal, this kid just rides his bicycle.
And we're back. I'm Malihe Razazan, and you are listening to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa on KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org, where you can go and give your pledge of support to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa to KPFA, kpfa.org, or 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And as a thank you gift, we will send you for a pledge of $100, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine, by our today's guest, Ben Ehrenreich.
Planet Hebron. It sounds like science fiction. And yet, it's amazing. The story
it exists.
He tells, yeah, it's sort of, I haven't read the book like you, Malihe, but I look forward to reading it.
It is truly an amazing book, and this book has been getting really rave reviews. And for example, Adam Hochschild, who wrote the new book, Spain in Our Heart, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 and 1939, and he has been a guest on KPFA, he actually writes that, I wish there were more reporters as brave as Ben, that they can go and immerse themselves in the Middle East, in Palestine, and they can write so honestly, truthfully, and in such a profound ways. 1-800-439-5732. We have about 10 more minutes to go, and this is the last time we are coming to you in 2016, I guess, unless I'm not sure if we're going to have more membership drives. But anyway, this is the last time that we're coming to you this membership drive. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org.
I was very interested by his take on why there's more and more tolerance for this kind of point of view, even within the mainstream. I thought that was also very edifying, that on the one hand, you have a lot of these old media kind of disappearing, largely through their own fault, because people don't trust them anymore. On the other hand, you have the Internet with, of course, good and bad. It's not all good information, but there's more information thanks to the Internet. So you have this new generation of Americans, of people across the globe, who are actually getting some information that is not filtered by the mainstream. And the mainstream that way is losing its hold, its death grip on society. And it's a very hopeful phenomenon to see people like him, Max Blumenthal, like Dave Zirin, and others really do their job unimpeded. I mean, it's hard because they have to get funded somehow. But they're able to do it.
Yes, 1-800-439-5732. Ben says that the climate of fear must not be allowed to stand. There is too much truth out there and too much hunger for it. And that's why we are here. I think we are hoping that we be that medium that can bring you these voices that you've heard on Voices of the Middle East and North Africa every week. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We have 9 more minutes to go. And we have The Gift is the Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine by Ben Ehrenreich. Again, I cannot say enough about this book. Raja Shahada, who's an amazing Palestinian writer, he says, it is all too easy to become overwhelmed by the glaring injustice and the difficulties a traveler encounters in the territories occupied by Israel. But Ben Ehrenreich resists the temptation. He remains enraged, but lucid, eloquent, and insightful. And I think that is a beautiful description of this book. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and for a pledge of $110, we will send you The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine.
Yes, and it's the nuance also that I like about his voice. It's not just a cliché, it's not just black and white. It's really a very lucid look at the terrain, at what's going on. He's not pushing some old stereotypes or some old cliches. He's really looking at things very carefully and describing them in a language that's just beautiful. It's very clear, very in a way very clinical. I mean, it has that passion, as you said. It's gripping reading, but at the same time, it's very truthful.
And I think another beautiful description of the book is by Mark Danner, who is a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. And he has been He has been on KPFA as well, and he has a new book out called The Spiral, which is basically about post 9/11 U.S. foreign policy. And he says that though often framed as a quote-unquote foreign policy problem, Palestine is a land of miracles and wonders with ordinary men and women who decline to consent to their own eradication, struggling against a vast landscape to live free lives one day at a time. And I think this is such an important time to really pay attention to what is happening, because U.S. and Israel just signed the biggest arms deal ever, $38 billion, I think. And we're going to be doing a show on it in the next couple of weeks to see where the money is going and where what is it that they are buying?
And the incestuous relationship.
Exactly.
Where does this country end and where does Israel begin?
It begins. We'll do a show about this. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. Please call us. We have about 5 minutes left.
And we have limited copies of this book. We have only 15 copies. And we have had an amazing reception and reaction from all your listeners today. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Ben writes, when I was touring for my book and everywhere I went meeting people who were eager and excited to talk, not all of them agreed with me about everything, which made me still happier, but I was heartened by the very clear fact that people in the U.S. seemed ready, hungry, even for a conversation about the realities of Palestinian life under occupation, a subject that has for years been verbatim in this country. 1-800-439-verboten, which is German for forbidden, exactly. And he says audiences were enthusiastically open to a perspective that they knew is far too rarely voiced here. And that what makes his book so amazing. As you said, it's nuanced. It's really a very nuanced book, and I think we learn a lot more about Palestine that we can learn from some books of history, because it's so intertwined with people's daily lives, and they experience it, and then he goes back and puts it in a historical perspective. 1-800, thank you so much for that support. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I want to thank some people. Thomas Gilberti from San Francisco. Thank you so much, Thomas. Also, Shakar Manta, thank you so much.
Santa Clara?
Yes, thank you so much. And then there are a couple of other people that don't want to be thanked.
Ella Lucy from Hayward.
Yes, thank you so
much. Thank you so very much.
1-800-439-5732. We have 4 more minutes to go, and I don't know how many more copies of the book we have, but give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. We will end this membership drive on Friday at 7 p.m. So you really have 2.5 days to give your support, to support KPFA financially. And also, this is the last time that we are coming to you. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org.
And I want to also thank Michael Perona of San Francisco. And James Murray from San Jose.
Yes, thank you so much. And also Adam Schatz, who's an amazing writer, and he writes at the London Review of Books. He says, as heartbreaking as it is, The Way to the Spring is also a strangely joyful book, because Aaron Wright grasps and the essence of the Palestinian struggle, not Islam, not even nationalism, but the stubborn refusal of injustice. And this is one of those rare books that Khalil, that he says, this is not about religion.
Well, it's the, it's the truth, but it was very rarely spoken.
Exactly.
Very rarely.
He says, this is not about religion. Right. This is not about ethnicity. This is not about where the geography, it's not about that. It's about injustice. It's about a historical injustice. And that's why he travels
all around in the West Bank to really try to bring us that story, which, as Adam Schatz says, this is not about Islam. It's not about nationalism, but a stubborn refusal of injustice, the restless search for how it would feel to be free. As Nina Simone said, the way to the spring is more than a work of journalism. It is a freedom song burning with humanity. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We have two more minutes and we have a few more copies of the book left. So if you would like to get a copy of this book, or if you don't want to get a copy of this book, but you really want to say, I do care about these voices, I want them to be on the air, and you encourage us by bringing more of these voices to our airwaves, please do give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. For $110, we will send you The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine by Ben Ehrenreich.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This is a book that's going to last. It's going to, you know, it's for the ages. I really think it's a very
good
book.
And you know, Khalil, it's so amazing. We're getting small donations of $25, $10.
And larger ones,
I think it's fantastic.
Too. Yeah, we've been getting
larger ones. And we will accept them, I have to say. I mean, we're not going to return them. 1-800-439-5732. I have... 10 seconds, actually. Thank you so much for listening to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We will be back next week with a brand new set of programs, I guess.
Yes, and thank you again for your support.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next...
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Arctic amplification, climate change and global warming. New challenges from the top of the world. Professor Peter Wadhams. The most important news for September that affects all of us, wherever we live, comes from the Arctic. But it's rarely covered. NBC4 on Tom Hartman. We're an exception.
Satellite imagery shows Arctic sea ice melting away to the second lowest level since records began in the late 1970s, creating more open ocean, which impacts global weather by adding heat and moisture for storms.
And welcome back. I'm very pleased to have on the line with us Professor Peter Wadhams. He's a professor of ocean physics, head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. You've written about an ice-free Arctic, the possibility, you predicted, the data has indicated that within the next few years, the Arctic will be completely ice-free for the first time in over 100,000 years. What are the consequences of that, the people on this planet?
There's a whole series of consequences, which are all, unfortunately, rather serious. Firstly, the retreat of the sea ice or the loss of the summer sea ice will mean that global warming will increase because you're changing a large area of white to dark. So you're reducing the average albedo of the planet, and that will mean that it's absorbing more radiation in summer. Secondly, there's going to be an acceleration of sea level rise because the warm air that's lying over this open water in the Arctic Ocean moves in over the island of Greenland and gives you surface melt of the Greenland ice sheet. We now found in 2012, for instance, that the entire surface of the Greenland ice sheet was starting to melt for a period in the summer, which is completely new. And this will mean that sea level rise will be accelerated because that meltwater runs off into the ocean. Possibly one of the most severe threats is the fact that the shallow waters off the Arctic coasts, especially the Siberian coasts, where there's very wide continental shelves with only about 50 to 100 meters of water depth, that water can warm up during the summer months. And this will give you positive temperatures on the seabed, which start to thaw out the seabed permafrost, which has been sitting there frozen since before the last ice age. This has never happened before, and because the sea ice never retreated very much in summer, so the water temperature couldn't rise above zero. The warming water thaws the permafrost, and the permafrost is acting as a cap for a very large amount of methane, which is sitting in the sediments underneath in the form of methane hydrates. So you release the pressure by releasing that permafrost. This methane comes out as huge bubble plumes. That's already happening. It's been detected by scientists all over the Russian Arctic, most recently by a Swedish expedition, before that by various US-Russian expeditions. Each time they go, there's more and more bubbles, plumes coming out. And the fear is that there'll be a general release of methane trapped under those sediments, which could cause a very rapid rise in the rate of sea level. We calculated it could give you 0.6 of a degree warming of the planet in 5 years. So I think we must be really afraid of a methane pulse.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams on the Tom Hartmann program in June 2016. And before that, a news clip from NBC4 of September 19, 2016. Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions, working from ice camps, icebreakers, and aircraft. He made 6 submerged voyages to the North Pole on Royal Navy submarines. Wadhams' research group in Cambridge has been the only UK group with the capacity to carry out field work on sea ice. With increasing urgency, Wadhams is calling attention to the melting sea ice of the Arctic. In his most recent book, A Farewell to Ice, he writes, "Our planet has changed color. Today from space, the top of the world in the northern summer looks blue instead of white. We have created an ocean where there was once an ice sheet. Polar ice is thinning and retreating with unprecedented speed. All our ingenuity cannot at present change that, because ice only grows in winter, but can melt year-round. Its growth rate is limited, while melt rate is unlimited." In a lecture in Milano, Italy, in May 2015, Peter Wadhams explained how the melting of the Arctic affects the rest of the world. There are very few scientists who so thoroughly understand the complexity of the climate system generated by the Arctic. Here's Professor Peter Wadhams in the first part of a one-hour lecture, Arctic Amplification, Climate Change and Global Warming, New Challenges from the Top of the World.
Now, they've given me a very long title, so therefore I'm going to have to give a very long lecture. And there are three main elements. One is Arctic amplification, which is the fact that the Arctic is warming faster than any other part of the world. Climate change, how fast is warming happening throughout the world, and therefore how much faster is it happening in the Arctic? And then what are the impacts that Arctic change is having on the world? And I hope to show that many of the important changes that are happening globally actually come from rapid change happening in the Arctic. The Arctic is helping to drive the whole process of climate change in the world. So we start with the amplification question. And this is the fact that if we look at the Arctic, we find it's warming faster than any other part of the world. And we know that with every possible source of data, it's been possible to reconstruct the climate record for the last 1,000 years. And we find that the climate gradually was getting cooler. We were slowly moving towards a new ice age. It was warmer in 1,000 years ago, so the Vikings were able to settle in Greenland. And then it got colder until in the mid-19th century, it was a very cold time. Then suddenly the climate changed and it got warmer very, very rapidly. And that corresponded to the Industrial Revolution, when we started burning coal, basically. And therefore we were putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from coal burning, and that started the whole process of man-induced global warming, anthropogenic warming. Well, if you look at the climate curve for the Arctic, this is all the stations north of 60 degrees, between 60 and 90, we find there's the same pattern as the rest of the world. But if we look at the scale, we find that the total amount of warming in the Arctic over that whole period has been something like 3 degrees. But if we look back at the world, we see the total amount of warming is only 0.8 of a degree. So the Arctic has followed the same pattern of warming as the rest of the world, but there's been much more warming, about three or four times as much. So that's Arctic amplification. When we compare all the stations, all the weather stations in the world, we find that the warming that's happened since the mid-20th century is very much greater in high northern latitudes than in over the world as a whole on average. So if we look at where that heating is concentrated, we find that the greatest warming is happening in the western part of the Arctic Ocean and in northern Baffin Bay. These are parts of the ocean which I'll show are actually ice-free now in the summer and didn't used to be. So the fact that there's open water there instead of ice means that the weather warms up. There's warmer air over the water because there isn't any ice on it. So the greatest warming is in parts of the Arctic where there used to be sea ice, but now there isn't. Now, in the planet as a whole, this is what's happened in the last few years. There's been some indication that the heating has flattened off, and this has been a kind of gift to people who don't believe in climate change. They think, well, nothing's happening because in the last 10 years, that the average temperature of the Earth hasn't gone up. But the amount of heating of the Earth has increased. The Arctic has continued to heat up very fast, and there is extra heat going into the planet, but instead of warming air temperatures, at the moment it's all being absorbed in the ocean and heating up the deep ocean, especially the Pacific Ocean. So if we look at this Arctic amplification and project it into the future, with climate models, we can see that the heat is going to be concentrated in the Arctic. We expect by the end of the century perhaps 7 degrees of warming, 7 to 8 degrees in the Arctic, and 3 to 4 degrees in the rest of the planet, which is still a lot, with, again, the big Arctic amplification. Now, let's look at climate change in the world as a whole. The two terms climate change and global warming are used interchangeably, but in fact we should really use the word climate change when we talk about natural changes that are happening due to all kinds of natural causes, and global warming to the specific change that's happening because of the carbon dioxide and other gases that we put into the atmosphere. So climate change is ice ages. That's because that's natural, and this is the record of temperatures over the last 400,000 years from ice cores drilled down through the Greenland and Antarctic ice caps, and we see that the Earth has passed through a cycle of extremely warm and extremely cold conditions. That's the ice ages and the interglacials, which are the periods in between. So we've had this kind of sawtooth pattern where we emerged from an ice age about 12,000 years ago, and we're up here now in the warm interglacial. But before that, we were deep in an ice age, about 4 degrees colder than we are now. And that was a gradual decrease of temperature from the previous interglacial, which we emerged from another ice age. So we have this pattern of sawtooth, which is actually due to astronomical factors. It's because the Earth's orbit has a slight wobble on it, and that alters the amount of radiation received by the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. So it's a natural phenomenon which causes glaciers to advance, give us an ice age, and then retreat, and we come out of the ice age. So if we allowed nature to take its course, we've come out of an ice age and we would be gradually sinking towards the next one. But we stopped sinking towards the next one. In fact, we're warming up. So this natural change is accompanied by a natural change in the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere. When there's a lot of glaciers around and there's not many plants growing, then there's less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there are natural limits to carbon dioxide levels between 180 and 270 parts per million. Nature would prefer us to be in this range of carbon dioxide levels. But now we look at what we've done at the end of last century and the 19th century, it's shot up and now it's over 400. So we've never had carbon dioxide levels as high as we have now, and it's entirely due to us burning coal and then oil. We've done this to our climate, but we've added this huge amount of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and we've added a lot of other gases also which cause greenhouse warming, nitrous oxide and methane. These are two other climate gases which both cause global warming and which have increased because of industrialization, methane from natural gas and nitrous oxide from, also from industrial processes. So we've done that and we're still doing it. There's for everything that you've heard about various global leaders promising to reduce carbon emissions is completely false. They've promised, but nobody's actually done anything. And the rate of increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere continues to increase exponentially. There's absolutely no evidence of any leveling off or reduction in carbon dioxide emissions by mankind. We really are addicted to burning things and producing carbon dioxide. So today, this is the present levels of carbon dioxide emissions. And we can see that in Europe, we can, and in the USA, we can feel all virtuous because Europe's gone down recently. And this is a bigger range of European countries. We've gone down. The USA has gone down slightly. But you can see that that's done at the cost of China and India rising very fast. It's essentially, we've given over our dirty manufacturing industries to China and India, and they do all the nasty things with factories producing things, and so they emit the carbon dioxide, and we can feel virtuous that we're not. But if you add it all together, because carbon dioxide has no nationality, it spreads throughout the world, the planet is increasing in carbon dioxide level still exponentially. The way we think about what it does to the climate is called radiative forcing. That is, the greenhouse gases, which actually are preventing the Earth from emitting long-wave radiation. So the Earth wants to emit radiation due to its own temperature, but the radiation can't get out because of the gases that are in the atmosphere that hold it back. So that restraint on emissions is as if we were adding to the solar radiation. It's as if we were warming the Earth more by adding solar radiation. So we think of it as radiative forcing. So these are then enables us to measure what the different gases do. And the biggest greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. Methane is coming along behind, about a quarter as much as carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide and halocarbons, that's the gases from air conditioning systems. So these are the big emitters. We're getting a little bit of radiative cooling from aerosols. That's the dirty stuff we put into the atmosphere. And that helps to compensate a bit. But on the whole, we have a large amount of positive radiative forcing, which is what's warming the planet. So that's global warming as opposed to climate change, which is natural. This is unnatural. So now I'm going to talk about what Arctic warming is doing to the planet and what its impacts are. And there are seven different kinds of impacts that I've identified, so I'm going to go through all seven. The first one is the sea ice retreat. That is, sea ice is retreating in the Arctic, and that's changing the albedo of the planet. That's changing the amount of radiation that's reflected back into space, because you're replacing a white surface by a dark surface. Then secondly, that the ice, because it's getting thinner and changing its nature, that's accelerating the retreat. So that's the second one. The third is that the warmed air over the Arctic is causing the Greenland ice sheet to melt more rapidly, and that's causing an acceleration in global sea level rise. Then the fourth one is that snow line, that's the area of snow in the Northern Hemisphere, has been going down as well very rapidly, and that in itself increases the albedo feedback. Then the fifth one is that there's a direct threat, which really does threaten our well-being at this moment, which is the threat from the emission of methane from offshore waters of the Arctic. And this is a problem we're looking at the moment. It's a very, very serious one. The sixth one is that the retreat of sea ice is causing extreme weather events, which we've all been experiencing the last two or three years, and that has an impact on global food production. That's also very, very serious. And finally, there's a decline, leave the good news till the end, there's a decline in the strength of the Arctic thermohaline circulation. I'll explain what that is later. It's the ocean circulation in the Atlantic, and the retreat of sea ice is causing changes there which are actually cooling Europe, but cooling mainly countries like Britain and not Central Europe. But they're not actually cooling Europe, but it's reducing the rate of warming of Europe. So that's, in a sense, it's good news for Europe, but bad news for the Gulf of Mexico, because that's warming up more rapidly. So let's look first at the sea ice retreat, number one, and then the associated question of the thinning of sea ice. Sea ice retreat was first noticed in about 1950, and until about 1950 it was difficult to measure anyway, because you had no instruments. You depended on sailors sailing around the ice edge, catching seals and whales, and saying where the ice edge was. And then from 1950 onwards, we started to have aerial surveys. And then from 1970s onwards, we had satellites. So our knowledge has got better and better. And we find that at all times of year, the Arctic sea ice has been retreating since about 1950. But the most rapid retreat has been in the summer months. That's July to September. And that's because the ice in the Arctic Ocean fills the Arctic Ocean round to the coastlines of Alaska and Siberia. And it's easier to see a retreat, because in summer the sea ice falls back from those coastlines and leaves some open water around the edges. So we can see it better in the summer. Starting 2005, in a typical summer, the ice fills nearly the whole Arctic basin. In winter, the ice covers the whole Arctic Ocean right up to the coastlines of Siberia and Alaska and Canada. But in the summer, it retreats a little bit. So if you're very brave and you can try and sail an icebreaker through the Northern Sea Route, that's this route around the north of Siberia, or the Northwest Passage, which is the sea route around from Baffin Bay across the north of Canada. But you have to be lucky and you have a lot of ice. But then in 2005, the ice started to retreat from that limit and we had more open water. Then in 2007, there was a much bigger retreat. A whole big chunk was taken out of the Arctic Ocean, giving you a big blue sea at the top end of the world, which was never there before. So this big area became ice-free. Then in 2012, there was an even bigger retreat, and this is the record so far. So it lies even further back. There's an even bigger area of open water in this part of the Arctic Ocean, which is called the Beaufort Sea, and less ice all round. So in only a decade, we've gone from the summer ice — that's summer in the Arctic means September, because that's when there's least ice — gone from summer ice filling the whole Arctic Ocean still, to summer ice only filling less than half of the Arctic Ocean. But this wasn't matched by climate models. The sort of official view of what's happening to climate is given by the periodic assessments by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But they make use of computer models of climate change, which on the whole for the planet as a whole work quite well, but they don't work for the Arctic. These are the models gave you gradually diminishing through this coming century to 2100 here. But what's actually happened is we've already got that amount of decrease by 2012. So the reality has been the ice has been collapsing, the ice area in summer has been falling away really fast. Then what does that mean in terms of changes to global warming? Well, there was a study done last year in the University of California where they looked at the loss of ice between summer now and summer 20 years ago and looked at what that does to this thing called global albedo. Albedo is the fraction of solar radiation falling on the surface of the Earth that's reflectedly out into space because the surface is bright or white. So a white surface, freshly fallen snow, has an albedo of about 90%. 90% of the solar radiation is reflected straight back into space. But open sea or land or forest has an albedo of less than 10%, so 90% of the radiation is absorbed. And the effect of this sea ice retreat in the Arctic alone, according to the calculations of these people at the University of California, has been to reduce the average albedo of the Earth from 52% to 48%, and it's the same as adding a quarter to the amount of heating of the planet due to greenhouse gases. But even that model doesn't take account of is the fact that the ice has been getting thinner and changing its character. So first of all, there's ice that's more than a year old. It's called multi-year ice. It's very thick, rugged kind of ice. But this last decade, the area of multi-year ice has gone right down. So nearly all the ice in the Arctic is now young ice, ice called first-year ice that's less than a year old. That's a huge change in the character of the ice in the Arctic. And we've been following the thickness changes by going underneath the ice with submarines, and British Navy submarines, and the US has been doing the same, and measuring the thickness of the ice from below. If you look at the Arctic as a whole and look at all the data, including the US data, there's been a thinning of between 40 and 50%. Not only is the ice smaller in area, but it's only half as thick as it used to be. So if we include the effect of the change in ice characteristics, the change in age, and multiply that by the change in area, we get a change in volume. And the volume change is a much more rapid decrease than the area change. The ice is shrinking, but as well as shrinking, it's getting thinner. And if you combine the shrinking of area and the thinning of the ice, the amount left is much less. So the amount that's there in the summer now is a quarter of what it was in the 1980s. Maybe in only 2 or 3 years' time, there won't be any ice in the Arctic in September. There'll be ice all the rest of the year, but in September, there'll be a disappearance. And the way this has been represented is this thing called the Arctic death spiral, which is that You take a graph where the distance from the center is the amount of the volume of ice at different months of the year. So September of 1979, there was this much. And if you go then forward in time to now, the volume goes right down until it's here, less than a quarter as much as there was in 1980. And every other month of the year, these are all the other months, the ice volume also goes down. But September is the month where it will disappear first, and then perhaps August and October. And then the winter months, the ice will stay longer, a few more decades. But it will still eventually go. It's decreasing both in area and in thickness. So that's something we should worry about.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The idea that an unequal capitalist economy will outperform in productivity a more egalitarian capitalist economy, there is absolutely no evidence to substantiate that. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming evidence that it's exactly the opposite.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hinnell. In this week's show, we speak to Robin Hinnell and how the economy functions in part one of a four-part series about the economy and how it affects our everyday lives and how it interacts with the political social sphere. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We are very privileged this afternoon to be joined by Dr. Robin Hinnell. And we are facing a series of questions. You know, we're approaching one of the most important elections perhaps on the planet, the election of a presidential candidate for the U.S. And on the mind of people, usually the top question is the economy. But very little is shared in terms of education in school about what is an economy. So why don't we begin there, Robin?
Well, what's important about the economy is that it produces the goods and services that we need. And it provides people with work. And what we now understand that we didn't understand before, we used to think, well, the only important goal is to increase economic productivity, basically reduce the number of hours that people have to work to get the same amount of goods and services or produce more goods and services, you know, every hour that we work. Besides that, sort of distributing the goods and services fairly, that was always a concern. I mean, it was a concern of some people, much less of a concern of others. The mainstream of the economics profession increasingly adopted the attitude, well, that's not our problem. Our problem is to tell people how to produce more goods and services and fewer in less time. But how it is that it's distributed and whether it's going to be distributed fairly, we'll leave that to philosophers and politicians, which was always a huge cop-out. But the other thing we have figured out is that we now have to pay attention. We live in a mostly full world, not a mostly empty world, to use a phrase from the ecological from ecological economists. And because we live in a full world, it means that we have to start worrying about how rapidly we're using scarce resources from the natural environment. And increasingly, what's even more important is how much we are using up environmental sinks to store the waste products that we produce. The most important environmental sink right now is the upper atmosphere where we store carbon emissions from our economic activity. So that's what we should care about. We should care about whether or not we're getting more useful goods and services per hour of our work. As long as work is less pleasant than leisure, then productivity increases are beneficial. You want to share those productivity increases fairly, and you want to do it in a way that does not increase strain on the natural environment. Those are the important things. We are not doing well in any of those regards at present. What we should not be distracted by is, are stock prices going up or down? Is the value of my house going up or down? Well, that is something that a person has to worry about. It's usually, for an ordinary person, if they own a house, it's practically the only wealth that they own. But your house stays the same, even when its market price goes up and down, only because you have to worry that you're going to take a loss on a sale. Do you worry about things such as that? So the values of assets, particularly financial assets and stock prices, that's all incidental and only of importance if it affects the real things, production, productivity, environmental protection, and distributive justice, if you want to just make it simple.
Now, when we think about a productive economy, I grew up in Latin America, and most of our economies were agricultural economies, and often people think of feudalist society, you know, where the king reaps the benefits of the peasants working the lands, and you get 50% of everything you cultivate, you just give it away to the king, whoever's in charge. And so we are told that capitalism was a good thing, that it was a natural transition from feudalism to capitalism. And I think it's important to learn where we come from so that we know where we are, first of all, to situate ourselves, and also to ask the question, is where we're heading a good place to continue to be walking in? So can we talk a little bit about this sort of, you know, mythology, in my opinion, of, you know, this natural transition to a system of capitalism that displaced many and continues to create profits on the basis of displacement, expropriation, and, you know, impoverishing of others?
In the advanced economies, how are we performing as far as increases in labor productivity, as far as the distribution of the, you know, the goods and services that we are generating, that people are making, and how are we progressing in terms of, you know, whether or not we are protecting the environment? Well, in all those regards, the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s right up to the present has basically diminished economic performance. Rates of growth of productivity in the advanced economies have slowed considerably. What little increases in productivity we have had over the past 30 years have been captured almost entirely by the top 1%. That's where the slogan for Occupy came from. It's a real actual number that over 80% of increases in economic productivity were captured by not just the top 1%, but in most cases to a great degree by the top 1/10 of 1% of wealthy people and rich people. And we have continued to simply spew pollutions into the environment and put ourselves in a situation where we have exhausted the sink services of the upper atmosphere as a storage place for our carbon emissions. So that's what's going on. I mean, that's a summary of how the economies have performed for people and the environment under the neoliberal period in the advanced economies over the past 30 years. And then on top of that, the financial system crashed the global economy and sent us into the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And in Europe, they really have failed to even sort of make a moderate comeback from all that. Now, if you look at Latin America, traditionally, as you know, the indigenous societies there had their own economies, which were certainly not capitalist economies, and they were not plantation agricultural economies. Those indigenous economies were virtually wiped out through disease and conquering and enslavement by the European settlers and colonial masters. And then what replaced them was an indigenous population that was sent to work in mines for extractive resources and who were enslaved basically as peasants on landed estates, large landed estates owned by European settlers, where productivity was very low. The owners of the landed estate lived quite well. The peasants who worked there for them, you know, had a very, very low standard of living. In the sort of early to mid-20th century, economists in Latin America, a very famous economist named Raul Prebisch, who was an Argentine economist, and he founded a division of the United Nations, ECLA, that did research on how could the economies of Latin America actually become productive economies rather than a peripheral part of the global economy that provided agriculture and raw materials to the manufacturing centers and the advanced economies. And they developed a program in the middle of the century that began industrialization processes in the Latin American economies. The name for that was import substitution. The successful countries engaged in what all advanced economies had engaged in before, the United States in particular, to protect our small and infant manufacturing industry. We placed high tariffs on products imported, manufacturing products imported from Europe and Great Britain in particular, until we grew manufacturing industries that could compete on a global scale. And Prebisch basically preached that doctrine in Latin America, and it was called import substitution. So instead of importing all their manufactured goods and exporting agricultural goods and raw materials, mining products, what they tried to do was say, no, we want to produce our own manufactured goods for our own domestic consumption. And that is the only way that we're going to have increases in productivity so that people can live better in Latin America. Now, that strategy was, for a whole sorts of reasons, that strategy was sort of set aside in the 1980s, particularly in the late 70s and 80s. Latin America was the first region of the world that was subject to this great new experiment called neoliberalism. And it had disastrous effects. It was a huge setback for the sort of incipient process of industrialization and self-sufficiency in manufacture. And it was a disaster. It basically was a disaster for the economic well-being of most Latin American citizens. And as the first place where neoliberalism was unleashed, and as a place where the consequences were particularly dire, the political reaction against neoliberalism also came first in Latin America. And we now have a name for it. People are calling it the pink tide. But it was a change in strategy on the part of progressives and revolutionaries. It was a move away from guerrilla opposition to imperialist capitalism and imposed neoliberalism. Guerrilla opposition in countryside, urban guerrillaism in places like Uruguay. All of those political movements of the 60s and the 70s were replaced by new progressive left movements that opposed the neoliberal trend in the continent. And they pursued new ways of doing that. Instead of armed resistance and trying to liberate territories militarily and protect them militarily, the opposition basically changed in two huge directions. The first was they started to concentrate on developing mass movements opposed to the most pernicious effects of neoliberalism. I mean, the labor movement had always been there, and the attempt to organize peasants for land reform had always been there. But we're talking about movements in the 1980s and the 1990s in all of the Latin American countries that organized around more issues and different issues. They continued to organize about land reform and workers' rights and unions, but they also organized around a host of other issues and developed mass movements, very powerful mass movements. And the second thing that was different, they had different forms of mass movements than they had before. The second thing that was different was they engaged in electoral politics. They said armed revolt didn't work. In the case of Cuba, it did. No place else did it really turn out, you know, to deliver lasting benefits. And so progressives, the mass movements, progressive movements, started to engage or work with political parties that were also running in elections. And that led to the election of a number of parties that and politicians and governments in Latin American countries in the 1990s and the 2000s that were built upon mass opposition to neoliberal forms of capitalism. Those countries included Argentina, Brazil. Those were more moderate responses. They also included Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia, where both the movements and the governments and the politicians were more radical and in some cases looked beyond any form of capitalism. They didn't limit their opposition to neoliberal forms of capitalism, what Chavez eventually called a kind of 21st century socialism. So the first place on the world that started to talk about, think about, and work to try and achieve a 21st century version of socialism, something different from the 20th century socialism of the Soviet Union and Stalin, was Latin America. And the first region of the world that rejected neoliberal the sort of neoliberal economic model was Latin America. So this was a very, very important experiment. These were very important things, and there were tremendous achievements in terms of economic well-being that these movements and these governments achieved. What has recently happened is they have had setbacks, and in almost every one of the Latin American countries, they've had setbacks. And there's a host of reasons for that that's very, very important for progressives and revolutionaries in Latin America to understand, and it's very important for progressives and revolutionaries in the rest of the world. When we're trying to learn lessons from people who have preceded us, in some ways, Latin America has been 5, 10, 15 years ahead of the rest of the world's political progressive movements and political parties and thinkers. So it's important that we have tremendous amount we can learn from them, both their successes and more recently their failures, to try and figure out what it is that has to be done better.
You know, when I was thinking about the way the social movements mobilize and organize in Latin America, there is this unifying vision that a world with more equity functions better. And, you know, epidemiologists have been telling us all along that when you have a society that has more equality, you have less incidence of disease, you have less incidence of crime. There's all sorts of benefits for having a society that is more equal. And yet, you know, if you go to any business school in North America, they'll tell you that inequality is just part of capitalism. You know, it's just part of the equation. It's natural that recessions are just the order of the day. From an economics point of view, what are some of the lessons that we can highlight of the examples that Latin America has set out, but also the ways that the temporary setbacks we are experiencing highlight for the movement?
The essential difference is neoliberal capitalism preaches the necessity of inequality in order for the system to function. It's trickle-down economics. It says the corporations and the wealthy, you have to basically pay them a ransom in order for them to allow the productive resources to be used and for innovation to flourish. What Latin America was the first region of the world in response to this resurgence of neoliberal capitalism, what they said in response was, well, in our experience, as you have made us even more unequal, our economies have actually performed even worse. And that when the benefits of economic activity are distributed more equally, then not only is it more fair, not only are the goods and services going to where they can be used best, you know, $100 increase in income for somebody who is dirt poor produces a huge increase in well-being compared to $100 increase of income in somebody who's already a millionaire. The social movements and the political parties, the new progressive political parties like the Workers' Party in Brazil and the Socialist Party in Venezuela, what they also argued was, if you take a look at the evidence, you will see that when you have a more egalitarian distribution of income, growth and productivity actually works better. And there is overwhelming statistical evidence for this if you look back over the last 100 years. The idea that an unequal capitalist economy will outperform in productivity a more egalitarian capitalist economy, there is absolutely no evidence to substantiate that. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming evidence that it's exactly the opposite. So one of the things that the movements opposed to neoliberalism in Latin America said loud and clear was, both because it's fair and because we believe it actually works better for, you know, economic performance, we are going to redistribute income, you know, from the very, very wealthy to people who have never enjoyed the benefits of economic development. And that is one of the successful things that the governments in Venezuela, the government in Venezuela, the government in Uruguay, the government in Argentina and Brazil, to a somewhat lesser extent, government in Ecuador, in Bolivia, they did that. They did a brilliant job of saying that we're going to now run the economy for ordinary people. and no longer simply run it for the plutocrats, the oligarchs, the super wealthy. What they did not succeed in doing was changing institutional power so that when circumstances became somewhat more difficult, they would not suffer political rollbacks. That's what we are seeing. Two things have changed for Latin America in terms of its position in the world. One is a lot of the progress that was made in Latin America, and Venezuela is the best example of this, was when the U.S. government, quite frankly, was bogged down in intervention in the Middle East, disastrous intervention. If you've seen the Tolkien movies, the Lord of the Rings, it's as if the eye of Sauron was distracted from Latin America, and it was focused over on the Middle East. And as a result, the degree to which the United States usually meddles, intervenes, and invades whenever governments start to oppose neoliberalism and U.S. dominance, that lessened to some extent. And there was sort of a breathing period. The other thing that was very beneficial from the short-run perspective was China was growing at a rate like no large part of the global economy has ever grown at that pace for about a 20-year time period. So China was buying up agricultural and mineral and raw material exports from Latin America. So there was a very favorable international market for commodity exports from Latin America. That included oil. I mean, the one that was most obvious was oil in Venezuela, but it wasn't just oil. It was agriculture, mining, oil. So there was a very favorable market for Latin America for this exact period of time when you had successful political movements opposing neoliberalism, when you had the U.S. government distracted in the Middle East. And both those things have changed recently. The United States is less bogged down abroad. I think there's every reason to fear that whether it's a Trump government or a Clinton government. Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State who basically tilted in favor of the coup d'etat in Honduras, even though the entire OAS said we won't recognize this new government that's thrown out a popular elected president. We're not going to recognize him. And the United States went ahead and said, well, we are, and we're going to go ahead. That was Hillary Clinton in the State Department. If she becomes president, there is no reason to believe that that she will be changing U.S. policy vis-a-vis Latin America in a beneficial direction. And the other thing that's happened is that the growth rate in China has slowed down, so that commodity prices have plummeted. And because the Latin American economies continue to be dependent on those very profitable exports, they are facing more difficulties in terms of making their economies work well for everybody.
When you point out the very stark reality that we are faced with two candidates who, in terms of geopolitical, offer very little to be hopeful for, I guess I want to bring the discussion back to the role of social movements, because in essence, social democracy is still a project that is, trying to develop, to be exercised. We have been working towards creating a political process that allows to elect people that will make choices and decisions in favor of the majority of the population, but that has not yet happened, And capitalism is not a one-size-fits-all. There are various variations of capitalism, and perhaps it's important to note the difference this make, whether it's a liberal society, a socialist society, or a neoconservative form of capitalism.
There's neoliberal capitalism. Hopefully people understand what that is like. In the advanced economies, it gives rise to Occupy movements because it's tremendously inegalitarian. And in lesser developed economies, it essentially denies them the means and the mechanisms to develop their own go through their own industrialization process in ways that improves the overall productivity of their workforce. So that's neoliberal, and that's one kind of capitalism. There's been another kind of capitalism that reached sort of its peak in the Scandinavian countries. Over there, it's called social democracy or social democratic capitalism. I think it also is the kind of capitalism that the movements in Latin America and the political parties opposed to neoliberal capitalism did a pretty good job of building during the past 20 years. It's social democratic, it's populist, and it's redistributive capitalism, where you are redistributing goods and services from the wealthy to the poor. You're making sure, for instance, that the oil revenues are actually going to provide health care and clinics, you know, for poor neighborhoods, and to import food and necessities and to provide education for the next generation, rather than simply having the oil revenues in Venezuela go to finance the luxury, you know, living habits of the Venezuelan elite. The third kind of economy is a revolutionary democratic socialism. And some of the governments, some of the pink-tied governments in Latin America, were committed to trying to make a transition from populist redistributive capitalism to some form of revolutionary democratic 21st century socialism. I mean, in the aftermath of the failed coup in Venezuela, that was the turning point for the Chavez government. Up until then, they had been about redistribution. They had not really made any serious moves to sort of replace capitalism itself. But after that, they did start to move in that direction. They started to move in that direction with communes, the People's Communes, political force. They started to move in that direction with a new constitution that was much more democratic than the previous constitution. That was the government that made the greatest attempt to take this next step, to somehow go from trying to reorganize a capitalist economy so it would better serve the interests of the majority, to reorganizing the economy so that it was actually managed and run by and in the power and the hands of ordinary people. They made considerable strides in that direction, but they slowed down. And I think one of the lessons to be learned is that populist redistributive capitalism is not stable, that if you don't keep moving forward and if you slow down the process of empowering the people who are benefiting from the redistribution to actually be in charge of the economy for themselves, that you always risk that when political circumstances become more difficult, that there will be huge setbacks. That's what's hopefully not going to happen in Venezuela, but appears to be a danger at this point. And it's certainly something we can already see has happened in Argentina and Brazil.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for doing this. On our next segment, we will be talking with Dr. Hanel about the role of the very structures that co-create our economies, and how do we engage in that process?